You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
Sometimes U.S. politics is in such bad shape that it helps to get an outside perspective. This week we are speaking with John Pilger from South London. He is, of course, a journalist, filmmaker, and author. He is one of only two to have won British journalism's highest award twice. For his documentary films, he has won an Emmy and a British Academy Award. His epic 1979 Cambodia Year Zero is ranked by the British Film Institute as one of the 10 most important documentaries of the 20th century. His Death of a Nation, filmed secretly in East Timor, had a worldwide impact in 1994. His books include Heroes, Distant Voices, Hidden Agendas, The New Rulers of the World, and Freedom Next Time. He is a recipient of Australia's International Human Rights Award, the Sydney Peace Prize, for, quote, enabling the voices of the powerless to be heard, and for fearless challenges to censorship in any form. You can find his articles, books, and even watch some of his films at johnpilger.com. John Pilger, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, Dave.
It's wonderful to have you on. I was particularly struck by a couple of articles you've written in recent weeks and months. One was about a world war having already begun, and another about silencing America during its electoral system. What do you mean by saying that a world war has begun?
Well, I think the attrition period has begun on two fronts, beckoning a world war, and the propaganda period has begun. That is the drum beating that always precedes the shooting, the bombing, and the violence. And that has happened, is happening, on two fronts, on Russia's western borders, where the biggest military buildup since the Second World War is well underway in the former Soviet states, and in Poland and Romania, Estonia, Ukraine in particular, where NATO is pressing hard on Russia's western border, the very gateway into Russia through which the Nazi army went during the Second War in Operation Barbarossa. You only have to read the Russian press, and the Russian press is rarely reported in the West, and it sounds like they're already at war and already defending themselves against NATO. The other front is in the Pacific, Asia-Pacific, where President Obama announced in 2011 his so-called pivot to Asia, which is also the biggest military buildup, certainly the biggest naval and air buildup in that region since the Second World War. And the target there is China. The U.S. has up to 400 bases that effectively encircle China in a big arc coming all the way up from Australia through Southeast Asia, Northern Asia, the Pacific, and across to Afghanistan, and in a great ring around China. The U.S. Navy itself is engaged just outside Chinese waters. This is a perspective, indeed both are perspectives, that are seldom reported, let alone understood, in the West and especially in the United States, and extraordinarily so in this election year.
It's a very strange sort of propaganda for war, because I think people in the United States would say there's no danger of war, nobody's talking war, we haven't heard about any wars, and there's sort of unawareness of this military buildup and the perspectives of the Russians and the Chinese. The only element that seems to really be there in the U.S. media is the demonization of Vladimir Putin and the sort of reversal, the allegations of Russian aggressions. But I don't think most Americans have any idea that it's a risk of war, much less nuclear war.
Well, David, since I've been reporting from and being in the United States, there's a kind of, how shall I describe it, a kind of incorporated willful ignorance that runs especially through the megaphones of the established order, which on paper is constitutionally the freest press in the world, but in fact is one of the more restricted. Not that it doesn't give us a great landscape of news, but that landscape is always restricted. And so it's not surprising to me, but it's getting to an extremely dangerous stage. You're quite right. We have the usual pantomime villain. The latest one is Vladimir Putin. The absurdity of the attacks on Putin have reached a level I haven't quite known for quite a long time, I must admit. When you have the leading liberal light in the New York Times, Paul Krugman, writing a ridiculous column that calls Donald Trump the Siberian candidate because he's allegedly in cahoots with Putin, it seems the entire class, especially the liberal class, has mislaid their sense of humor. Trump, in a very sarcastic remark, suggested that that Putin might be responsible for, or might like to be responsible for the source of the missing 3,000 emails. Famous missing 3,000.
30,000, I think it is.
Yeah. And they all took it seriously in a kind of pathetic sort of evoking of the McCarthy period. And now Donald Trump's demonology is now linked to Vladimir Putin's demonology. They love their demons.
Indeed.
That's a wonderful way of distracting from finding out anything, to telling people what's really going on, to analyzing events and developments. And I know this is election year and it's a freak show in many ways, but it's an important freak show. The demonizing of Putin, especially, is so dangerous. I mean, Putin himself has done everything he can to be what he keeps calling, and I don't know why he keeps using the word, a partner of the United States. There are other elements in Russia don't especially want to be a partner of this country that keeps threatening Russia. They're rather more nationalist. But the U.S. continues to undermine the Russian leader who actually wants to be their friend and offers no threat whatsoever to Europe or certainly the United States. So it's a kind of, it's reminds me of those newsreels during the 1950s when all the school kids used to leap onto their school desks.
Yeah.
They were being trained about an atomic attack coming and the bad Russians were on their way. It's not all that different, really.
I think it's it reached a point now, John Pilger, where Trump has displaced Vladimir Putin as the top enemy of liberals.
Oh, yes.
And not just liberals, I can tell you, but peace activists who will tell you that if Trump likes Putin, Putin is evil. If Trump wants to get rid of NATO, we need NATO. If Trump says overthrowing governments is no good anymore, we need to overthrow more governments. If Trump says the Iraq war was a mistake, the Iraq war is now heroic. And what I want to know from you is how people outside the United States see this. Do they see Trump as the bigger outrage, the bigger evil fascist fear, or Hillary Clinton? Have they seen through a Barack Obama after 7.5 years or not? You know, what is the perspective?
Well, you would hope they would. But it's very difficult to answer that question because everything outside the United States, as within the United States, is filtered through a media that really echoes much of the willful ignorance I was talking about earlier. There's no doubt that Trump makes himself into a demon. His statements and abusive ways are just grotesque. I sort of would look on him, I suppose, as just yet another Republican running for the U.S. president, but he's gone a bit beyond that. There's almost a cult of Trump now around the world, sort of fundamentalism of Trump. So, I was with a group of people recently and reasonably informed and talking politics and popped Trump. And I said, well, I don't think Trump is, from our point of view outside the United States, if we have to say, I answer the question, who is the most dangerous to us? I'm not sure that we could say Trump. I think Hillary Clinton's record is far more dangerous to us. And you have to add, that doesn't mean to say I support this dreadful man. If I was an American, I wouldn't vote for him. I wouldn't vote, probably. But, for those of us who don't have a vote in the United States, in having this discussion, Trump certainly is the demon. And my saying that Clinton was the most dangerous took them by surprise. So the answer to your question is there is a version of that kind of one-dimensional thinking outside the U.S., certainly over here. Yeah.
When it became very clear, and the leaked emails through WikiLeaks helped with this, but it was clear for many months that the primary process between Clinton and Bernie Sanders was rigged and corrupt and unfair, so that there was no way you could say that Hillary Clinton actually won. It occurred to me what the U.S. media would have made of that had it happened in any other country.
Well, yes, they would have. Of course, they would have. The double standard is like on the national seal. It says double standard because when that's on the bottom part, on the top part, it says hypocrisy, because it doesn't apply to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And of course, if it was in another country, the New York Times would be trumpeting the iniquities of that system, that country. No, and I think Donald Trump has alluded to the fact they might try and rig the thing against him. I think there's not a bad chance of that. George W. Bush got through two elections, but not. Certainly the first one in 2000. And I mean, the point about Trump is he, apart from all his odious attacks on people, is that he has terrified the established order in the United States. They've never known anything like this for a very long time. I was thinking back the other day and thinking, you know, when John Kennedy ran, that great Kennedy entity, and it was there, they were then Roman Catholics, which of course excited all the bigots. But the Kennedy power also threatened, it seemed at that time, also threatened the established order in the United States. Of course, it didn't really threaten it. It would chime in with it very quickly. But it appeared to threaten it. There's something similar, although the people are very, the two candidates are very different, but there's something similar here. Trump, from the Republican side, from the so-called right, although they're all right, but from that part of the right, he's threatening the established order. And he's, what has really terrified them, which is interesting, and I mentioned Paul Krugman's column, and there have been many, many others associating Trump with almost a kind of anti-Americanism of saying he's pro-Putin, pro-Russia. Well, Trump has made a number of remarks that have suggested, only suggested, that he doesn't want NATO to do what it is now doing. He doesn't want to have a war with Russia, and he doesn't want to have a war with China. I don't know whether we can believe him at all, but he, the fact that he's even intimated that has created this hysteria so insecure, apparently, are the forces that control the United States and much of the world, that they see Trump as a possible Trojan horse. And he has said some interesting things. So you listen to Stephen F. Cohen, professor at Cornell, New York University, his Russian expert.
Yes,
Stephen
indeed.
He has analyzed a lot of what Trump has said about Russia and drawn some very interesting conclusions from it. Again, we don't know whether to believe him or not, but those messages have been taken very badly by those who run the country, in the media, all the usual suspects, New York Times, Washington Post, all the rest of them. So, therefore, the two have to be put together, demonized as a criminal pair, and discredited.
Well,
the strange things are happening. And, you know, it looks like, because Hillary Clinton's got such an appalling record, and much of it is on the record, it looks like it may all come to the wire, unless they can work the Electoral College to ensure that she wins, or a few other things. It may well come down to the wire. It's very interesting.
Well, can I tell you, my fear is that while Kennedy may have been a threat initially to some in the establishment, he became more and more of a threat every day he was in office, to the point where they may very well have murdered him. Whereas Trump is a danger and a fear to the establishment now. But if he gets into office, someone who has talked about handing out nukes to other countries and let's start killing their families as if the United States policy for centuries hasn't been killing families. And,
yeah.
and as soon as there's an incident, as soon as, you know, he in his acceptance speech, he talked about war with Iran to get back at Iran for humiliating U.S. soldiers by making them get on their knees when they sailed their ship into Iranian waters. As soon as there's an incident, as soon as a plane goes down and Russia's blamed, that's it. It's all over. You know, I mean, isn't he going to understand that using the military gets him more attention than not using it? Isn't he going to make as many wars as Hillary Clinton?
I don't know the answer to that, David. I think my feeling is that they're two sides of the same coin.
Indeed.
You know? But the point is that Clinton, though, represents she's got a record. I mean, ironically, the liberal media talk ceaselessly about her record. Obama yesterday, in his unctuous endorsement of Clinton, talked about not only endorsement of Clinton, but his attack on Trump, and the theme was that Clinton is experienced. She knows what it's all about. Well, she sure is. They're absolutely right. And that record of Clinton, particularly her time as U.S. Secretary of State, and also her time as so-called First Lady or Deputy President, whatever she was, during the husband's administration.
Bill Clinton's Dick Cheney, yeah.
Well, something like that. And she represents, I can't think of another politician whose record so clearly represents the straight line of, certainly of U.S. foreign policy and in many ways of U.S. domestic policy. Whereas Trump, who knows? I suppose that in itself is very worrying. But we know what Clinton will do. I mean, that excellent journalist Gareth Porter, who's done some of the really superb investigative pieces. You only read them on the internet, of course, on Iran and. And he works from Washington, of course. I mean, he described the other day Clinton's national security people that are already talking about attacking countries and how unusual this was and how early this was. They usually wait for a while. They might do it in between the period of being elected and actually taking office, as Obama did with in the first attack on Gaza, but they're already talking about how rapacious a Clinton foreign policy would be.
Indeed, on Syria.
You know, we have this very dangerous situation now with the U.S. and China. It's not at the point that the situation with the U.S. and Russia is, but it's rapidly approaching that. We have that largely because Hillary Clinton, as U.S. Secretary of State, in 2010 intervened when the Aquino government in the Philippines was sitting down to bilateral talks with China and bribed them effectively to take it to the international tribunal rather than resolve this important regional dispute between the players themselves. And because, as she said then, famously, the Spratly Islands, the South China Sea, is now a U.S. interest. Well, it always was a U.S. interest. But
yeah.
she upped the ante quite unnecessarily. Whether that would have been resolved, I don't know, but it probably would be between China, Philippines, ASEAN, all these countries are quite eager to resolve as much as they can regional disputes. She intervened. And you only have to read the speech she made in Santiago a few weeks ago. A lot of it was attacking Trump, but it was all about military. And here's Obama, and Clinton at her nomination, then Obama follows it up with an attack on Libya, a country that he, and especially Hillary Clinton, effectively destroyed. An attack on the very city, Sirte, which was flattened by NATO aircraft with Hillary Clinton back in Washington, cheering them on and orchestrating much of it. So, her record is known. It's not a very good choice. It's a terrible, hideous choice. But my point is that using Trump as a demon in order to distract from the danger of Hillary Clinton is something that people should wake up to.
They should indeed. We've got about 2 minutes left. John Pilger, I of course am going to vote for and support my friend Jill Stein and the building of a more educated and principled and powerful peace movement to counter whoever gets into power. What do you make of your home country of Australia's role in U.S. war madness? It seems to have become one of the partners, indeed, in its own prison and torture scandals and racism and U.S. troops on the ground and participation in every war.
It's always had those, David. People often take much notice. I wouldn't say partner. Australia is literally, and I don't even say this in a pejorative sense, is the 51st state. The Australian political system and its military is integrated with the United States. If you go to the Australian National War Memorial, the great majority of the wars in which a disproportionate number of Australians were killed, the colonial wars, first following Britain and then following slavishly the United States. Famously, Prime Minister Menzies wrote a letter virtually pleading to be allowed to send Australian troops to support the U.S. in Vietnam and so on and so on.
Well, there is...
So I suppose if vassal state applies to any, it certainly... applies to Australia. Australia, though, it does have a problem because its biggest trading partner is China.
Well, we're going to have to take that up on the next program. I wish we could go on for hours, but we are now better educated than we were. John Pilger, thank you for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, one of the legacies of Michael Brown's killing 2 years ago this week was the exposure of police departments like Ferguson's that have a system for profiting from fines and fees for low-level infractions that targets African Americans disproportionately. That's only one aspect of the interrelationship between economics, race, and criminal justice, our guest says calls out for scrutiny. Donna Murch is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers and author of Living for the City, Migration, Education, and the Rise of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. We'll talk about her new essay, Paying for Punishment, The New Debtor's Prison. Also on the show, the GMO industry is emphatic that genetically engineered food is absolutely 100% fine and healthy and good, and, oddly, equally emphatic that it should be hard for people to know whether or not they're eating it. We'll catch up with the latest turn in the battle over labeling and the public's right to know with Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. There are many big social and political stories to be told out of Rio, and some that, though smaller, are meaningful in their way. From 1932, when women's gymnastics first appeared at the Olympics, until 1992, only white women took part. Dominique Dawes, with Betty Aquino, the first African-American gymnast to compete and then to medal, cried 20 years later, watching Gabby Douglas become the first black woman to win gold in the all-around. Working as a commentator, Dawes said she was thrilled to change her website to say that she was no longer the only, but just the first. Which brings us to Simone Biles, three-time world champion and breakout star of the Rio Olympics. And as one of what is still a tiny percentage of African-American gymnasts, an icon to many, and particularly many young girls of color. Many eyes were watching then as NBC learned a lesson, maybe. Biles has been open about her family. She and her sister were adopted at a young age by her maternal grandfather and his wife. I call them mom and dad. Everything's just been so normal, she's been quoted. But NBC announcer Al Troutwig seemed to feel he knew better and referred repeatedly to Biles' grandparents. When someone on Twitter noted that that was incorrect, Troutwig responded, quote, "They may be mom and dad, but they are not, capital letters, her parents," close quote. After, one imagines, a phone call from PR, Troutwig declared he regretted that he wasn't more clear in his wording, though he didn't explain what it was he was trying to word or why. USA Today wrote that he apologized, quote, "for suggesting that Simone Biles' parents through adoption are not really her parents," close quote. Yes, if saying they are not her parents is suggesting they are not her parents, then sure. Olympics coverage involves a lot of storytelling. Commentators create narratives for athletes, and no doubt some feel it's humanizing when, faced with one of the best athletes in the world, they focus on what one called her broken home. Of course, what they're really revealing is just the narrowness of their vision. And if you wonder why you seem to learn so little about gymnastics from watching gymnastics, The New Yorker explains that NBC wants it that way. Writer Reeves Wiedemann says Olympics commentator Nastya Lukin told him, quote, "My producer always puts a note card in front of me, like, talk to Madeline in Middle America, who doesn't know gymnastics," close quote. The network has an explanation for the relatively low information quotient compared to sports coverage generally. More women than men watch the Olympics. And, says Chief Marketing Officer John Miller, quote, "they're less interested in the result and more interested in the journey," close quote. Finally, Colombia's Supreme Court has ordered the government to ensure that the Wayuu, the largest indigenous community in the country, have access to basics of survival, including drinkable water. Last year, the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights called attention to the crisis, noting the documented deaths of more than 4,700 Wayuu children in just the last 8 years, although the Wayuu themselves say the number is closer to 14,000 children who have died from preventable disease, thirst, and malnutrition. It's a humanitarian nightmare. But as human rights lawyer Dan Kovalik noted in a piece for Huffington Post, corporate media appear unmoved. The Wayuu are suffering not just from climate change-driven drought, but from the loss of access to the Rancheria River, drained by a dam built in 2011 for the coal mining company Cerrejón. The Cerrejón mine, at first a joint venture between Colombia and Exxon, opened in 1983 and has been displacing indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities ever since. Kovalik reports that Cerrejón now uses 17 million liters of water a day, while residents of the region have an average of 0.7 liters to live on. The area's dryness was noted in an article last December on CNN's website that told how, quote, Colombia's wild northeast is slowly making its way onto the tourist map. But patience and a fair dose of discomfort are required to enjoy this barren outpost, close quote. The Wayuu are mentioned. Readers are warned they'll be pestered by them for money and candy, so bring a bag of gummy bears. And that was one of the vanishingly small number of media mentions. India Country Today has done reporting. Al Jazeera had an informative photo essay. And some papers ran an op-ed by Jim Hightower. But in, say, the New York Times, which Kovalik notes has a lot of time for stories on shortages and privation in neighboring Venezuela, the story of the displacement and deaths of indigenous people just over the border doesn't seem to make the cut. One piece last September about Venezuela closing its border did mention the group when the paper informed readers in the final paragraph that, quote, many Wayuu have long relied on smuggling to earn a living, close quote. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. When Newt Gingrich comes out for criminal justice reform, you are right to look under the hood, to question just how deep this popular reform is intended to go. Any improvements that help real people are to be wished for, but policing and prisons are systems with deep and far-reaching roots in U.S. life. We ought to have questions about reform that comes without an honest reckoning with the fact that some of what we call problems in the criminal justice system are not so much bugs as features. Our next guest engages these questions in an essay called Paying for Punishment, The New Debtor's Prison, which appears in the July-August issue of Boston Review. Donna Murch is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, author of Living for the City, Migration, Education, and the Rise of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, and of the forthcoming Asada Taught Me, State Violence and Mass Incarceration from the Black Panthers to the Movement for Black Lives. She joins us now by phone from Inwood. Welcome to Counterspin, Donna Murch.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, this piece talks about ways that the state at various levels extracts money from criminalized people. What does that look like? What happens?
Well, I started researching this piece after being solicited to write a piece on the criminalization of debt. And what I found out is that it's really, the two are related to each other, but this process of indebting people that have been criminalized by the state is really, I think, our most pressing problem and really a modern form of debtor's prison. Some people call it debtor's prison 2.0. And I think what really called attention to this was Ferguson. So the protests in Ferguson are known for highlighting the militarization of police, and that was the most obvious. But through a combination of the street protest and also organizing groups like Arch City Defenders, people discovered that Ferguson had this whole system of profiteering off of its black population. So the black population is about 66%, I think it's about two-thirds, but a significant portion, between 20 and 25% of municipal revenue, came from a whole system of ticketing and criminalization that targeted the black population overwhelmingly. And I use an example of this from Ferguson about how Michael Brown is shot in the context of Darren Wilson stopping him as he's crossing the street in this, you know, it's really not even a street, it's a lane inside the housing development where he lived. But the offense for which he was being accosted for was walking in the street, which is illegal in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And 95% of people that are given that citation are African American. So when Ferguson happened, I think it shined a light on something that's a long-term problem, which is these ways that the state, especially municipalities and states, it doesn't happen in the federal system, use the entire criminal justice system to raise revenue. And I think that's really important because often when we think of incarceration, particularly in this moment since 2008, the sheer cost of it has always been seen as a potential unifying force between bipartisan and left and right consensus. But the truth is that while people usually think about private prisons as the main way that incarceration makes money, they're actually much more direct. And I would say, you know, people are still gathering information about this nationally, but whole systems not only of charging people for criminal justice debt, legal financial obligations, where if you are arrested, immediately you begin to incur criminal justice debt. So people are charged for every step along the way of incarceration, being put in a jail, being charged jail fees. If you receive a public defender, and 80% of people who are prosecuted are considered indigent. So the majority, in order to receive legal representation, receive public defenders. If you choose not to go to jail and instead the court allows you a system of electronic monitoring, many municipalities have a system called offender-funded justice in which you have to pay for the cost of wearing an electronic bracelet. And that in particular, I think, represents the future for the criminal justice system. So it's all these ways that they extract money from the most vulnerable populations, and they are also incentivized to arrest people because it raises money.
Well, isn't there a law against it? It sounds naive, but I mean, I thought there was something in the law that acknowledged that a person who can't pay can't pay.
One of the things that set the United States apart from Europe was that relatively early on in the 19th century, it outlaws debtor's prison. But what's happened, I think, in the last 40 years with the system of mass incarceration is that it's really just grown. You know, it's like a monster that keeps growing in many different ways. And I think much of this, there haven't been yet the constitutional challenges to this, but it's grown up through individual municipal court practices and then through ways that essentially private debt collectors have gained the system. So I think ultimately you have activists that are fighting this. The ACLU has played an important role in this, people challenging the practices of municipal courts. But I think that this larger campaign of punishment, in many ways, you know, if you can incarcerate people for long periods of time for minor offenses, incarcerating them for a debt becomes much less controversial. So I think these practices ultimately will be rendered unconstitutional, but I think that they've been able to proliferate because of, you know, kind of the consensus around punishment in the U.S.
Yeah, I was on a talk show once, and a caller was defending the practice of referring to people as illegals, and he had hit on a technique that he liked. He said, that person who overstayed his visa, did he break the law or not? Did he break the law or not? You know, and he just kept repeating that. And there's an insistence that what's being objected to is not the person's race or their status, but simply their placement on the wrong side of the law, which implicitly applies equally to everyone. You know, homeless people are arrested for public urination, not for homelessness. You know, it sort of seems like the conversation can't move forward unless it's taken to a different level where we talk about how laws are made and how laws are enforced, because otherwise this idea that someone has broken the law is kind of a thought stopper.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely crucial. In many states, if you've been convicted of a felony, you lose the right to vote for the period you're serving in prison, and in some states permanently, in other states for a designated period of time. Something that people know much less about is that in many states, if you have criminal justice debt of the kind that I've been talking about, which almost all people who are incarcerated incur this, you know, it was a real surprise to me because I'm someone who writes about the war on drugs and mass incarceration, but I wasn't even aware of the system of extraction until I started researching it for this article, that 41 states charge people for the cost of imprisonment and 44 states charge people for the cost of probation. So what that means is that nearly everyone who's being arrested or incarcerated is incurring criminal justice debt. And in many states, you can be stripped of your right to vote until you pay off all of your criminal justice debt. So I talk about that essentially as a modern-day poll tax.
Well, the self-perpetuating cycle that you write about of debt and criminalization and incarceration doesn't just ruin individual lives, it also distorts our understanding of crime and of poverty and of their relationship. It's hard to overstate, really, how much this connection, this confluence of factors has shaped the present landscape. And that's one of the things that you talk about, you know, the effect cumulatively on the racial wealth gap, for instance.
Yeah, I think that that's really one of the central points in the piece. I have kind of a large historical arc. I'm a historian. And so I go back and I talk about the system of debt peonage and convict leasing that followed the Civil War, because in many ways it's a precedent for what we're seeing today. And when you look at incarceration through the prism of resource extraction, it's overwhelmingly directed at African Americans. So again, I think the case of Ferguson became this illustrative case. And it's illustrative largely because people mobilized and fought back. That's really important. We know about this story because of social protest.
Absolutely. Well, activists know that you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I sort of seem to be making fun of this kind of left-right convergence on criminal justice reform, but we have to use the energy of the current moment to push for better. I wonder, what do you see as the hopeful glimmers at the moment, and what is the role for media?
I start out my article by talking about left-right consensus. And I'm a little bit critical of it, not because I don't think the coalitions are important, but because I'm really, in a way, trying to examine the motives of some of the more conservative elements that are weighing in on incarceration and sentencing reform. For example, expanding probation through electronic monitoring has been a way to talk about decarceration. But the problem with it is that it deeply indebts people and, as we've been talking about today, provides this incentive for greater criminalization. Especially this year with the election campaign, there's a lot of discussion of neoliberalism, you know, which is the idea of what happens when market practices are applied to different kinds of public goods. And this is a very concrete way that neoliberalism intersects with mass incarceration. So it's not just about the state rolling back social welfare and public goods. It's about the state allowing the upward redistribution of wealth from America's most vulnerable people, who are overwhelmingly Black and brown. Looking at the recent policy platform that came out for the Movement for Black Lives, I think it's very exciting to see the convergence of people fighting for economic redistribution and against state violence.
We've been speaking with Donna Murch, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University. Her article, Paying for Punishment, The New Debtor's Prison, can be found online at bostonreview.net. Donna Murch, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Obama signs bill requiring labeling of GMO foods, was the headline in the Washington Post. But then why are many of the activists who've been fighting for the labeling of genetically engineered foods calling the legislation the Dark Act for denying Americans the right to know? We're joined now by Patty Lavera. She's Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Patty Lavera.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What does this bill that Barack Obama signed late last month and to very little fanfare, there were a lot of other things going on, what does the bill say it does?
This has been a fight for a while. This is the end of one phase of a very long fight about whether or not people get to know if there's genetically engineered ingredients in the food they're buying. Several states, Connecticut, Maine, and Vermont, had passed laws saying in our state you're going to have to label these GMO ingredients. So that's things like corn and soy, some sugar comes from GMO sugar beets. So it's a lot of ingredients in processed foods. And Vermont's law went into effect on July 1st. This caused a lot of angst in the biotech industry that makes GMO seeds and the food processing industry that they didn't want to label at all, and they really didn't want to label for one state, and they created, we think, a false crisis, that we were going to have a patchwork of laws around the country, that they couldn't handle that, they couldn't deal with differing state laws, and they came to Washington to make Vermont's law go away. That's what this bill actually does, and it replaces Vermont's law with a yet-to-be-defined, incredibly weak standard that we're afraid is not going to give people real labeling.
Well, that expression, patchwork of laws, I came across that more than once, and it made it sound as though that really was the concern, a kind of process concern that different states would have different rules, but different states have different rules for things in other situations. And of course, for many activists, working at the state level has been a place where they can have more effectiveness.
Absolutely. And I can't really even convey the sense of hysteria that was created in the halls of Congress by these companies that is not accurate. And we were not embarking on a crisis in Vermont or anywhere else. Vermont was the first state whose law went into effect. Connecticut and Maine had waiting periods. And, you know, folks have been working all over the country in lots of states to pass these laws. And they were working together and they were using very similar language. There wasn't ever going to be a patchwork these companies couldn't live with, but it was a very convenient talking point for them to block a requirement that they didn't want to comply with.
Well, it's interesting because it's not about even the safety of GMOs. I mean, we have labels about gluten and vitamins and heart healthiness. It's an argument against information.
It is. And so these same companies, I mean, these are big. So the biggest proponent of the bill that the president signed was the Grocery Manufacturers Association, right? So they're representing huge food processing companies who operate all over the world. You know, Kellogg's is not just making cereal here and selling it here. They're selling it all over the world. And over 60 countries around the world have some kind of GMO labeling law. We're actually very late to this issue in the United States. And meanwhile, the GMO producers, the companies Monsanto and DuPont that make GMO seeds, maintain they're different enough that they should be able to patent those seeds. But when it comes to us eating the finished product, it's not different at all, and you don't need to know that it's there. So they're trying to have it both ways, and it's really an absurd amount of money and effort that we just spent having this fight, like a ridiculous amount of money was spent. And if you're so proud of the technology and the products that it makes, put it on the label and make your case and tell us how great it is, and we can choose it.
Absolutely. And or, you know, failing that from media's perspective, to not call that out, then in trade, I want to never hear about the glories of unfettered capitalism, you know, again, you know, because that relies on an informed consumer making economic choices. But now, in terms of what some of the information that we have about the labeling solution that this legislation calls for, my understanding is that there's a class bias implicit in it as well, or just a kind of class cluelessness in that it's going to rely on information that you get through your smartphone. What's happening there?
I know, it sounds made up. You know, there were many attempts to pass this bill. The House passed a version last year that pretty much just blocked those state bills and didn't do much else. Then we moved to the Senate, and the Senate tried in the spring to bring a bill forward that kind of looked like that, just pretty much blocking the states, and we were able to defeat that. And that's when the really kind of behind-the-scenes negotiating began. And what, with lots of Democratic support, unfortunately, because lots of Democrats in the Senate drew the line in the right place in March, and they said, no, you're taking away these state labels and people need them. And then the negotiating began, and Senator Debbie Stabenow from Michigan was involved in that with Senator Pat Roberts from Kansas. And they came out with a deal that, you know, was supposed to be a compromise we were all supposed to live with. And a key part of that was that companies get to choose how they're going to make a disclosure. And one of the choices is one of those QR codes, which is that box with the black and white squiggly print that you're supposed to scan with an app on your smartphone. And when we know that big companies will take that when they're given the choice because they lobbied for it. They spent the last year saying, we don't want a mandatory requirement, but if you do a mandatory requirement, we should be able to do it with these codes. That's not labeling. You have to have a smartphone, have a data plan that you've paid up for the month, have a signal in the store, which is not a given in most urban areas when stores are in basements of apartment buildings and things like that, and really have an extra hand. If you've got a shopping cart and a kid and a couple boxes of cereal you're looking at, I don't know how you're supposed to hold the smartphone and scan the code and look at a website and see if it contains GMOs. It's not a label, but yet that's where all those headlines came from, that they created this national standard for labeling.
It sounds very much like turning information into a luxury, and I can't think of anything more anti-democratic than that. But I want to pull you back to a point that you made that's fascinating, that GMO makers patent these things because they are different enough for them to be able to patent. And yet when it comes to labeling, and I understand that the backstory here is that the FDA decided decades ago that GE foods didn't need to be labeled because they weren't materially different. Is that the idea? The industry's run a long way with that.
Right. The GMO experiment began in the mid-90s, where the first GMO crops came onto the market. And the FDA was the one that said, yes, you know, they're acceptable. You can put them on the market. People can eat them. And they made a decision at that point not to require labeling. And we've been in a hole ever since, you know, trying to get some labeling requirements. So this starts with the federal government's failure to require labeling, which is in large part why people went to the states, you know, to get a better response from a legislative process and a democratic process that was working better for them than the feds who dropped the ball on this for 20 years. So, yeah, it's very frustrating. It's a very frustrating issue when you get right down to that core concept you mentioned earlier of people making an informed choice. That's all we're asking for. We have a whole other list of critiques and concerns about how GMOs are regulated. We don't think they're the same. When you look at the whole food chain that uses them, we think there's a lot of differences. But if we're going to tell people that they're voting with their dollars and they're making decisions, you have to give them all the information. And when we came to that line, the industry wasn't willing to do that.
Well, let me ask you finally, what now for activists? There is a large community of people who care very much about this set of issues. I can't imagine everyone's just going to lay down for this. Where does the fight go next?
The first thing is there's still accountability to be had on this, so people need to go look at how their members of Congress voted on this issue. And despite the headlines and what comes out of the food industry, voting for this bill was a mistake, and people need to let their members of Congress know that. There are steps that the USDA is going to take this bill and put it into action. They have to define some of the terms. We're going to do the best we can in that process, and we're going to need the public to help us with that. But in terms of the immediate thing of what do I do as a consumer, the things to keep an eye out for are, you know, certified organic foods. Organic farmers cannot use GMOs. They're not allowed to grow them. And there's also a label called the Non-GMO Project. It's a third party saying, you know, this product doesn't have GMOs in it. So those are options for people in the meantime if they're looking to avoid GMOs. But we would prefer to say where they are. That was the whole point of this, not to label around it. But in the meantime, that's kind of what we're left with.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch. You can find their work on this and other issues online at foodandwaterwatch.org. Patty Lavera, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith. There are undercurrents of new movements in many countries. When and how does social change arise? On July 3, 2008, I recorded this speech by legendary American activist Tom Hayden. The speech was broadcast in Vancouver, but this is its first appearance on Radio EcoShock. I call it Birth of a Movement. As usual, we're going to do a little rabble-rousing, digging for the alternative point of view. Our feature speaker today is the legendary Tom Hayden. He was a founder of the Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, in the United States in the early 1960s. Hayden was one of the Chicago Seven arrested at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. By then, he was already a famous civil rights and peace activist, a career he has never quit. With his wife Jane Fonda, Tom Hayden also became a prominent environmental campaigner in California before becoming elected as a state senator. Author of numerous books and articles, and currently campaigning against war and torture, Tom Hayden journeyed to Vancouver, Canada. He is supporting a fundraising effort for 19 students arrested at the University of British Columbia during a peaceful protest against on-campus development. To explain the circumstances of those arrests and the consequences, we begin with a brief introduction by the University Student Council Vice President and a member of the newly revived SDS, Stephanie Ratchin. That is followed by a quick introduction of Tom Hayden by another SDS leader, and then a powerful 49-minute speech on war, peace, organizing, and the state of the left.
We'd like to thank, of course, Mr. Hayden for being here today. We'll say a bit more about him before he comes on. But before that, we also have two other members of SDS-UBC, Nate Crompton and Stephanie Ratchin, who will be speaking. I understand Stephanie will be speaking first. Steph is a vice president currently on the student council at UBC, a longstanding member of SDS-UBC, and has been working on bringing the message of SDS-UBC to the more official organs of student government. And she's going to be speaking a bit about what SDS-UBC has been doing this past year, as well as about the arrests of April the 4th, that all the money raised today will be going towards the legal defense for. So without...
Thanks a lot for showing up tonight. Yeah, so when I was approached to come and talk about the SDS and what we're doing over at UBC and in Vancouver, it was a bit of a difficult task initially to figure out what I was going to say, especially in the context of being very busy with the AMS, the Alma Mater Society at UBC, and also in the context of in whose presence I was going to be talking about the SDS UBC initiatives about. So I guess while there is much room for improvement, the stuff that we're doing does take on many different forms. I guess I should begin with a little bit of history of this collective here in Vancouver. It's not that old that we've been labeled as the SDS, although it was not a spontaneous measure by any means. What happened was last summer there was a group of student activists that came together who had been active within their respective communities and active on their various interests for quite some time, and were really frustrated with not only how our society operates, but also how our educational institutes operate and how they perpetuate ideals that are very, very harmful in a lot of different ways. So there's been a lot of tactics that we've undertaken as a result of this as well. There's definitely been direct action tactics. I can remember about 2 years ago at the University of British Columbia, there was a proposal to build a shopping mall in the middle of campus with a bus loop or an underground bus loop underneath and market-priced housing over top. And for those of you that do live in Vancouver, you know how expensive market housing is these days. And one of the things that, as soon as that announcement was made, a bunch of students ran around with petitions and got about 4,500 signatures in about a week to oppose this development. But again, like, petitions aren't enough, although it did cause a stir. People went to Board of Governors meetings and so on and so forth. But what happened as a result of this petition was it eventually grew into a park. There was a park that was set up in September of this past school year in opposition to again, the development proposal for the area. And this park was pretty interesting in the sense that it was a natural park. There was murals, there was grass. And I think some of the things that we really learned from that was, wow, taking up physical space really can make a difference in the sense that there was a lot of support generated from it. But there was also a lot of controversy generated from it as well. I mean, lots of people weren't really used to seeing, number one, students take action, and also students taking action in this kind of a format. I mean, it was a park. There was people planting grass in a parking lot that grew. there was also picnic tables, and there was also a pretty big geodesic dome that came out of it, which has been affectionately known as the Democracy Dome. But there's also been other kinds of initiatives that we've taken place. Like Jeremy mentioned, it's not only myself that have become involved within the student government at UBC. There's Tristan Markle in the back, and Nate himself, Ren as well. And I think what we're trying to do in that is we realize that there are a lot of problems that we're facing right now. But we need to not only work outside these systems, but we also need to take over these systems. And we need to do these in a productive and positive manner to implement the change that we really do want to see manifested in our own environments. Yeah, a lot of our efforts have been successful as a result of our actions. There will be no shopping mall in the center of the campus. There's going to be a student union building, and there's going to be a student union building instead. and those negotiations are currently being undertaken. I guess, yeah, like what I want to talk about is that, but again, this park, and I should also talk about why we're here tonight and also some of the legal struggles that we've encountered, is that this park had a pretty big impact, not only in terms of the effectiveness, but also in terms of how angry some people got to see students being active, but also students opposing these kinds of educational structures that were happening. Like, for example, on April 4th, when we had an open concert with local musicians coming out to play, there was a lot of security and police surveillance in the area, just kind of questioning what was going on in the area. And although they didn't actually go into the area, at least not initially, there was a lot of questions being raised as to what is this. So on that night, what happened? I mean, there's a Police and Peaceful protest brochure out front, and I highly recommend that all of you take it on your way out. This gives a little bit more of an accurate description as to the specifics of what went down that night. But I do want to mention that this was a peaceful protest. 19 students were arrested. There were students that were taken from the crowd arbitrarily from the police, pulled from the crowd as bystanders, thrown in jail for 24 hours, and then released with criminal charges. These charges are still pending. A lot of these students are also international students. This will have a significant effect on their ability to travel across the border. It has a significant effect on their ability to complete their own education. There are restrictions on these students, on their ability to attend their own campus right now. Not only in terms of the restrictions, there's the financial aspect as well. I mean, having gone through this process myself, it's really been an interesting ordeal in terms of the kind of forces that we're dealing with in terms of where is the justice if, as students, were coming in having protested, but then we're faced with thousands of dollars with illegal charges now, criminal charges, for having asserted our right for peaceful protest. Yeah, so I just wanted to mention that and thank you all for coming here tonight, and that I am really looking forward to hearing what Tom Hayden has to say. Thank you.
Those were great comments. Thanks. Bob Dylan actually said it all about the 60s. He said it was an unidentified flying object that landed, but not everybody saw it. In other words, things arise mysteriously without advance notice, without press agents, without advance people. And that was what the 60s were about. And when I heard that SDS was forming again, it puzzled me, but it didn't particularly surprise me for the reasons given. And when I heard that there'd been some arrests for the honorable Vancouver tradition of resisting malls, I thought, I'm there. I'm there. But I had no idea of the eloquence, and I appreciate it. I was going to flog these books, but here's what we'll do. These books just arrived. I'm going to describe them to you, and then we're going to sell all of them at an exorbitant price, if possible, pay off the publisher, and then the rest of the money will go to the SDS Defense Fund. Is that fine with you? All right, so this can be in any currency you like.
Clean money. Huh?
Except that. This one may interest you. I only have a couple of them. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who is older than I am, and who is the founder of City Lights Bookstore and Books, and the kind of the godfather of the Beat Generation, the poem Howl was read under his auspices by Allen Ginsberg with Jack Kerouac sitting in the front row at an evening something like this, or many evenings that you've been through. It was sold for 25 cents at the time, and Ferlinghetti immediately was put on trial, and the books had to be shipped in from somewhere in England by barge, and they were seized by the customs inspector. And so this whole battle in the 1950s that preceded the 60s over the right to howl. Since protest was unimaginable, howling became the only thing that a person with a heart and soul and mind and spirit could do. So Ferlinghetti's still around, and he and City Lights asked me to compile 50 years of my writings from high school to now, or at least till quite recently. And it's kind of an eyewitness history of our lifetimes, the last 50 years, as seen from the only desirable angle to see from, right? What's that? No. Location, location, location. It's not a real estate notion. It's the streets or from the grassroots to see the panorama of history as experienced there. The second book is just out this week because there's this 40th anniversary of 1968 that has the attention of the media and some people, and there's a Democratic convention in Denver. And after the Chicago conspiracy trial, a couple of people named Ron Sasse and Frank Condon wrote a marvelous, I thought, play, a production of the Chicago conspiracy trial with good balance. And I've seen it performed several times on campuses. I highly recommend it to any campus theater group. And so the play with some commentary is in this second book in hopes that, it, as suggested, it can be brought to life through the spirit of this generation calling up the spirit of previous generations on stage. And having seen it, I can say it's a great production. And then for the truly ideological and obscure among you, I brought the actual Port Huron Statement with a commentary. This is an example of something, a lesson I'd like to share with you. This was a document that was conceived in December 1961 when this group SDS was forming, and somebody said, well, we have to have a manifesto or a vision or what you would call today in the corporate world a mission statement or in the NGO world, one of those little. So they said, Hayden, you write that. So I drafted this mission statement, and it became like 75 single-space pages, and it got to people 5 days before the founding convention. And they got very mad, but they found that they could sit in small circles and break it down into parts, foreign policy, energy policy, economics, government, and then they could kind of own it by talking about it for 5 days and then casting a vote on whether to concur with it and then give it back to me for a final polish, and off it went. And we thought it was a great experience for us internally, coming to terms with what we actually believed, but had no idea whether it was of any value in its 25-cent print edition form, which we mimeographed on a Gestetner and then stood and sold to people, I guess, or they just took it. But it became really seen as this epical document, the visionary call of the 60s revolution. Howard Zinn says it's one of those historic documents which represents an era. I think Zinn is closer. When the 60s began, of course, there was no 60s. I never heard anybody said, let's start the 60s. Somewhere in the decade, long about 66, reporters thought there was an era upon us, and they couldn't name it, and they wanted to know who had started it. And all these things have to start, of course, with a manifesto, as in a certain historic tradition. So they uncovered this document, the Port Huron Statement. There was a lot of questions. Where was Port Huron? It's near Canada, we can say that. And its sports teams are called the Big Reds. Very suspicious. And who wrote it? Hayden wrote it. And it became really prominent for people to explain the 60s to other people. And it's had a lot of reprints, usually a few paragraphs, in college texts. You have probably seen it referred to somewhere. Am I right? Or I think I'm right. It's like there's been no mass marketing, there's been no media campaign or advertising campaign, but it's made its way into the culture. But this is the actual document with all kinds of brilliant things, like how important the 1961 the UN's declaration of the International Geophysical Year. That was one of the things that we thought was extremely important to note. Also, a brilliant idea that soon we would have community control with nuclear power stations in the center of every community to break the chain of the monopolies. Every community like Vancouver would have its own little power plant to run energy self-sufficient projects. I could go on. But that's youthful idealism at its finest, and it's available to you for $10 Canadian. I'm no expert on the mall issue, but it does seem to me that universities around the world are being privatized and the cost is going up. I went to university for $100 a year. Now you kind of join the chain gang thinking that it's a privilege. You go to university, you go into debt, and you live for a very long time in debt. And I think this accounts in many ways for the decline of discretionary time for revolution or protest or even free thinking. But also it explains, you know, many of the circumstances that disturb or even alienate people today. There was an article in the New York Times today, I believe, that said, my generation is aging in the faculty, and that was a good thing because we're being replaced by moderates. And there was a lot of discussion of what a moderate was, but if I read the article carefully, the difference was that the 60s professors were driven by values, according to the New York Times, and the current professors are driven by data. And that's the world I've really looked forward to bringing about, you know, from dreams to data.
You're listening to the great 1960s activist and later California Senator Tom Hayden speaking at the refoundation of the Students for a Democratic Society at the University of British Columbia in 2008.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I think that I'm going to speak more generally in just a moment, but I think that working on an issue on the campus, really, about the price of housing, the university as a development corporation, turning the students into little consumers, conceiving of the educational process as a market process in which little units are filled with information and sent on their way, is a very sad legacy and doesn't bode well for the future of rounded, healthy, self-sufficient human beings, cultivated and educated human beings. So how do you grapple with something like that? I think that going to college, university, is not like a parenthesis in life where life stops and you study for a while, but that it's a time in which you're free to do certain things that you may not have the discretion or freedom to do in a very few short years. And if you think locally and deal with your own immediate consciousness as a young person, as a student, a consciousness that I appreciate but I don't come from, then everything in the seemingly small world around you will be a revelation of the larger world that is causing it. And the practice of standing up to authority, the practice of standing up to indifferent students, dealing with the kind of feeling of exclusion and cringing that you go through when you hand out leaflets to people that don't want to receive them, these are all experiences that are the best preparatory experiences, real experiences, in building a democracy that you can have. So the local is kind of a laboratory. The classroom is a laboratory. And so I'm very happy that that students have been alive enough to be concerned about these issues and very upset that university or authorities would be so indifferent that their resolution would be arrest and sort of criminalization of what was a legitimate protest. Okay? Now, I just want to talk about two things for a few minutes each. I know some of you are standing. I want to commend and congratulate Emily back there. Wave your hand, please. She's been... She's been the spokesperson. She's been tormenting me, actually, on the phone. And I've been back and forth about whether you would get 100 people here. And the 100th person just came in the room. Very important. Very, very important to achieve your goals. Even more important to set goals. My goal currently is... to discuss the 60s only as a secondary background to my life. We'll get to that. But I want to talk to you about Iraq, Afghanistan, the role of Canada and the United States governments and our social movements, because that's what I do with my life now. I never hoped to do this. I was a civil rights activist. I was a student activist. Every time I try to do something about the malls in my backyard, L.A. City Council, state legislature, there always was another war. This may be familiar to you looking over the border, but by one school of thought, the United States is always at war somewhere. As Lyndon Johnson once said, you can't go to sleep without 100 million people making trouble somewhere. He did say that. Usually more poignant, destructive, visible wars occur at a rapidity that's breathtaking, about every 5 years. So I keep trying to come back to improving the quality of life in my own country, and I keep finding my government straying away from my country, claiming that my country is not safe without 800 military bases, several secret wars, and two or three big ones going on at the same time. I'm speaking here about Iraq, where we have 140,000, 160,000 U.S. troops. Afghanistan, where there's 60,000 Western troops, including Canadian. Of course, 30, 40,000 of them are U.S. troops. The coming war in Pakistan, which is already a kind of war. And if you read the American press and the British press, you see the drumbeat in the media has already begun, just as it did in 2002 about Iraq, the theory being that Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda Central Committee meet in the mountains around the Khyber Pass. They're protected by the Pashtun tribal groups. They're protected by the military of Pakistan and even by the democratically elected government of Pakistan. And that's the reason that we in the United States and Canada are soon going to be attacked. Unless we engage in a preemptive war, which is already underway with commandos, by bombing and destroying any targets imaginable in the famous centers of world revolution, South Waziristan and North Waziristan. So that's your job. In my time, the job was to stop the madness of the Cold War thermonuclear arms race. In this generation, you will be blighted, I guarantee it, slowly but surely and sometimes traumatically by the dangers in the world posed by the war on terror or the alleged war on terror. And whoever is the next president, I can guarantee you, while we may begin withdrawing troops from Iraq, we will not be withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. And we will be increasing those troops in Afghanistan and probably in Pakistan. These are only the visible wars. So the impact of that, according to Dr. Stiglitz and Bilmes at Harvard, is a $3 trillion war overall in a 20-year time frame, probably $10 billion so far. From Canadians, a conflict which will take 5 or 10,000 American lives and leave 50 or 60,000 Americans wounded in ways that are so traumatic that they cost a lifetime of suffering and taxpayer expense, and 100 Canadians, 200 Canadians, on it will go. Until people in Canada, people in my country, find a way to resist and stop this alleged solution to the problem, which I think only makes the problem deeper. I'm not one on the left who thinks there's no problem. You know, there are some who actually believe that we in the United States attacked ourselves in order to invent 9/11. Just as they believe that Roosevelt allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm not one of those people. I believe, though, that my family, my 8-year-old, are threatened every second of every day by provocative policies that can only lead to a cycle of provocation that will lead to unnecessary American and Canadian deaths and losses in dollars, losses in Canadian currency, losses in honor, and probably above all, losses in direction, because we will never have the resources to deal with the problems of global warming, environmental restoration, illiteracy, improving the college opportunities, providing schools for little kids, providing more health care, particularly for seniors, and so on. These are not costs that can be addressed by simply recruiting more people and printing more money.
You are tuned to the Brown Bagger program on CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Our speaker is Tom Hayden, the famous social activist from California. This speech was recorded by Alex Smith on July 3, 2008.
Now, in particular, I hope that in the coming days you will sign a protest. Maybe people who are signing at the door can sign a sheet of paper and send it to your immigration minister, interior minister, prime minister, representatives to say no to any deportation of these American war resistors who are here.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. With Trump and Sanders or new parties in Europe, this 2008 speech by California activist Tom Hayden is important. Hayden was a founder of Students for a Democratic Society in the 60s, was one of the Chicago Seven, and with his wife Jane Fonda, was an early environmental activist. He became a California senator. I recorded this speech at the University of British Columbia following student protests there. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
This shouldn't even be a chore for us. This is not the 60s. There was a time when Canada and the Trudeau government welcomed, I don't know how many of you in this room are among them, but welcomed, it was 50,000 Americans, no? Yeah. Over the border, I came, I spoke to them. There was freedom in the air, there was tension. It really happened. Jimmy Carter then brought them back. It wasn't so long ago. Here we're talking about 25 to 50 or 75 people. You know what this is? This attempt at deportation against the will of the Canadian people, against the will of the Canadian Parliament. You know what it is? It's a favor by Stephen Harper to George Bush on his way out of office. It's really crass. It's dishonorable. To send a handful of young men back to the Pentagon's prisons because they were able to see that they were going to be shredded by an indifferent war machine if they went to Iraq or Afghanistan. They should be credited with having some foresight, and the matter should rest until we get a new president and we get the war over with. This is not a repeat of the 60s, as some Canadians I hear on the radio are always saying, these boys should have known. They were not forced into the draft. They chose to do this. I think you know the answer to that. We have an economic draft where young men that can't get health care, can't get jobs, can't get into college. They're surrounded by recruiters at the door of every high school and community college in the States. They're pounding on the door. They're making offers, go to Afghanistan, go to Iraq, go into the army. They make it sound like it's a tropical vacation, that vacation in the desert. You should enjoy the benefits that you'll get from your time served over there. You'll see camels, you'll see pyramids, you'll make more money than you ever will in your miserable life, and on and on and on, and they don't stop. And the schools are forced to turn over the data and the phone numbers. They don't stop until they meet their quota and more go over into the meat grinder to become one of them, as John Kerry famously once said, the last to die in a lost cause, the last to die in Iraq or Afghanistan, is to be stopped. So it's coming to a head in Canada, and I would hope that it can be stopped. But it's not the only dimension. The other thing that is noteworthy to me about Canada is the fight put up by many Canadians to speak out against the Central Intelligence Agency's rendition program, the case of Mr. Arar, the ability of Canada to weigh in against torture is not inconsequential. It is appreciated in my country. It is noticed in the Pentagon. It is noticed in the White House. And I have to tell you, and in case you have not figured this out already, that torture is not a random act of isolated, aggravated, frustrated, overwrought prison guards. You know, every disaster is always blamed on a few bad apples. I have to tell you that torture and abuse and the suspension of human rights, including the Geneva Convention, particularly Article 3, is an inevitable byproduct of a counterinsurgency strategy that depends on securing the population against the alleged insurgents. A lot of sweeps, a lot of knocking down doors, and a lot of holding people in detention camps without charges. If this sounds made up, how many of you remember the Phoenix program? The Phoenix program is an ill-named program in South Vietnam in which the CIA and USAID funded South Vietnamese police going into villages and identifying what they called the Viet Cong infrastructure, mayors, peasant leaders, doctors, nurses, teachers, you know, people who were running villages which were outside the control of the United States. And they summarily executed, killed tens of thousands of them and rounded up 10, 20, 30, 50,000 more in strategic hamlets, call it a concentration camp, whatever you like. The chief advisor on counterinsurgency to General David Petraeus in Iraq in 2004 wrote an article in a journal called Small Wars advocating a global Phoenix program. Based on Vietnam, he said, the Phoenix program in Vietnam has a much maligned history. It was actually quite effective. It should be carried out globally. The experimental laboratories would be Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, but globally. He withdrew the phrase 3 years later after a number of us hammered at it, and he just renamed the program what its original name was in South Vietnam, the Village Rural Community Development Program or something like that. But it's the same word for word advocacy. So let me sum it up like this. You know about Abu Ghraib. You know about how many people have been targeted for death and executed in Iraq. It's huge numbers documented by the International Red Cross, by mainstream media, and so on. But today there are 100,000 people in Afghanistan and in Iraq, young men, who are held in detention camps, held indefinitely. They're rounded up. They're held. Whether they're tortured or not, the point is that they lack any of the rights accorded to detainees under international human rights standards. They do not have lawyers. They do not have charges against them. They do not expect to see a judge. They will not get out unless they are subject to overcrowding and expelled. They are simply in a state of captivity, of preventive detention. It was called in apartheid South Africa. Anybody that has to preventively detain in camps without rights, a substantial portion of its younger generation has given up on its future or is afraid of its future. So to support international human rights groups or religious groups, go to stopfundingtorture.com and get informed. There are things that can be done from Canada, from Europe, from all over the world. I know the burden of the struggle is on ourselves in the States, but start to understand torture is a moral issue, yes, but what if it is actually an integral byproduct of the kind of warfare that we have chosen to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq, like Central America in the 1970s, South Vietnam in the 1960s, Algeria in the 1950s, Malaysia in the early 1950s, Kenya in the 1950s, on it goes. There's a whole literature out there. A lot of people in the peace movement say, study war no more. maybe you've sung the song, I can appreciate that. But I think you have to study war more. I don't think we're educated enough in the doctrines of war and the execution of war to make us qualified to comment and criticize what is going on right before our eyes, although it's described in very neutral terms in the papers. If you know more about what we're doing, about counterinsurgency, you'll be more fortified in the struggle to undercut the funding for these secret prisons and detention camps. A lot of people ask me, well, how do you get any hope when you spend all your time thinking about torture? I ask myself, well, what kind of people don't think about torture? It's a terrible choice, but I would much rather be concentrating all the time on ending torture and suffering and thinking about it than not. I call not denial or ignorance. It's not a pretty picture. It doesn't have a happy ending. People are suffering every day. I know that. But it seems to me that if you put people pressure against the pillars of the policy will end. By that I mean your grassroots pressure shouldn't just be unfocused, but there are certain pillars that are necessary. Stephen Harper has some shaky pillars in that Canadian Parliament. Try to pull those parliamentary pillars and public opinion pillars away from his policies. You know, the votes to go on another year or another 3 years in Afghanistan are votes that separate majority from minority by less than 10. It's single digits. Imagine what you could do if you could get a parliamentary majority to just say no, enough. Secondly, it requires the pillar of the military. I know there are some people in Canada who are always trying to stir up a military spirit, thinking that's what's lacking in Canada. That, to me, is what's best about Canada. And to give the militarists a hard time is to put pressure on their ability to recruit and their ability to just suck up people to blindly go off fighting for flag and country. A third pillar is the budget. It costs a lot of money. $10 billion in Canadian money has gone just to Afghanistan. So go to the groups that are hurting in terms of the Canadian budget. May not be anti-war groups at all. Maybe senior citizens, healthcare workers, and broaden your coalition around the budget issues. The money for Afghanistan could go for domestic issues. That's the way I sort of view it. The more mobilization against the pillars of the policy, the better. It's something every single group, every single individual can do, and cumulatively, the pillars are worn down. That's the way that wars end.
Radio EcoShock. Bright voices in dark times. Get more. EcoShock.info. You're listening to the great 1960s activist and later California Senator Tom Hayden speaking at the refoundation of the Students for a Democratic Society at the University of British Columbia in 2008.
I want to say something about, just springing from that one last point, about the process of social change. They're beating at the doors if you want to let them in. When I say the pressure on the pillars, you may be thinking, well, what does that include for between electoral politics and civil disobedience, between moderate, pragmatic, and militant? It means everything. Like it or not, I think like a sociologist. I try to see that there's diversity here. Not everybody can agree on everything. Not everybody will choose the same tactics. My job as an organizer is to get the maximum unity of direction out of everybody rather than make everybody do the same thing, which they won't anyway. Make them go in the same direction. So if you want to do civil disobedience, my question would be, what is your message to the undecided voter, right? If you want to do electoral politics, my question is, are you building lists and strengthening community organizations so when the election's over, you feel stronger and that your voice is louder for future community movements or future elections, and so on? Here's, if you want to memorize this with the letter M, here's my model for social change. There's two forces you want to think about. There's the Machiavellians. Machiavellians are the inheritors of that 15th century spirit of anything goes, right? How many of you are forced to read The Prince or wanted to read The Prince? Mm-hmm. It's a very simple book, but it's read by the Karl Rove people today. The basic idea is, how can you keep the incumbent in office longer and expand the power of the incumbent? So any methods that expand the power, appearing to be liberal, appearing to be charitable, appearing to be harsh, lying, anything that expands the power of the incumbent is deemed to be moral, because politics, according to Machiavelli, has its own unique moral foundation, which is the accumulation and holding of power for its own sake. So today these would be the manipulative power technicians who work for the corporations and the government and the media and the entertainment industry and so on. They're always faced by public opinion, nasty little factor. And public opinion is always shaped by social movements. So social movements against Machiavellians is the idea. And instead of instead of it being a Marxist idea, which is based on class, this is more a sociological idea that's based on power conflicts that do not end. Follow? In Marxism and Christianity, the conflicts between good and evil, between proletariat and ruling class, always climax in a plateau that is either called heaven or communism. And there's no further dialectic or contradiction. That's simply because in those days, that's the kind of worldview that people inherited, religiously or ideologically. But we know, having lived long enough, that contradictions never end. So I'm more of the yin-yang school of thought, of conflicting cycles between movements and Machiavellians. And the movements always start mysteriously. By that, I mean they are never announced. No professor, prophet, journalist has ever announced that in the coming days a social movement will arise. It's always reported later. We can go into the mysteries in the question. Secondly, they grow out of a handful of people, and they continue to grow if they resonate with the other people who are not involved, because they resonate in the memory of previous social movements. Then they go through a stage of a rite of passage that I call moments of trial, where they can be snuffed out and suppressed because the authorities act swiftly and ruthlessly, or they survive the trial of memory, the moment of memory, and they grow because more people become sympathetic. Like when we were on trial in Chicago, we could have gone to jail for 10 years. We could have died in prison. We didn't. We became sort of icons, and the movement grew. It expanded. We survived the moment. Then they get to the mainstream, defined as 25 to 40% popular support. And now, whether you like it or not, politicians get involved. I'm not one who believes it's a question of whether to get involved in politics. I'm one who believes politics gets involved in us. So when you're at 30 or 40%, some politicians will want to be in your picket line, some will want to be calling for your arrest, and most of them will be fudging their position in case you prove to be right. you can get maybe a little money for your bail fund from one of their friends or lawyers, but not directly from them because they don't want to take the risk of being too involved with you. But that's the mainstream. And then finally, they reach a point where they have a firm majority for the right to vote, let's say. And then it's irreversible. They will win the original demand. It may take 100 years. It may take 100 days. But they will win because the Machiavellians will split between those who still want to attack, and those who want to accommodate because they think, after all, their system can survive if half the population, that is women, get the right to vote. They don't want that to happen, but gradually over time they get used to it. They know that the consequences would be worse. The women would be angrier. They would be more radicalized. They would link up with unions. They might become revolutionaries. And so to restore the social order, the Machiavellians agree to reform. So the pragmatic movement wins by a coalition with the moderate Machiavellians. At that point, the movement splits and loses its base because when you win, you demobilize. Your mass support goes back to enjoy what they won. They don't like going to meetings every night like this meeting. They'd rather watch TV or enjoy, contemplate the right to vote. And the Machiavellians on the right get angrier. They start a counter-movement to try to cut back, contain, and suffocate the reform that's been achieved. And then the rest is fought out with the final M, the field of memory, which is about museums, malls, monuments, where people decide, the movement people always want the legacy to remain great. You know, that there has to be a memorial everywhere to Tommy Douglas or whomever, right? Martin Luther King. The reactionary Machiavellians want all memory eliminated, that the 60s simply didn't happen, as you said, right? Didn't happen. Then there's the worst group I call the politicians of memory, who are ruthlessly amoral people who simply want to capture memory for their own purposes of maintaining in power. So they name streets after people. The funniest one I'll just end with is in Chicago we had a huge anarchist movement at the end of the 19th century and bombs were thrown by God knows who. Police died, anarchists died. Horrible 1880s. And for 100 years, 120 years, there was a Chicago debate about how to memorialize the Haymarket events. They used to call them events, right? And finally, just 6 years ago, they had a sculptor and they designed a plaza in memory of the Haymarket events. And the key to it, according to the sculptor, was to make sure that nothing in the memorial site remembered violence. Instead, they said the way to remember the events was that they led to the eight-hour day. They led to the reform. This was something that the police in Chicago could agree with because they could say our brothers and sisters in the labor movement achieved the eight-hour day. We're for that. Outside the event were modern-day anarchists who were picketing with signs that said something like, what happened to us? In other words, they pacified memory completely by refusing to remember what happened in the place that they were memorializing. And it worked. It got tremendous publicity, and people felt it was really a good thing for the city. They used phrases that you may be familiar with. Let's close that page of our sordid history. Let's move on. Those sort of phrases. That's what I mean by the fight over memory. And so in that sense, in conclusion, I agree very much that that the fight over memory is crucial. It doesn't mean we should live in the past. It doesn't mean we should dwell on it. But we should remember that there were people before us, long before us. Many of them are forgotten. Each forgotten forerunner is a shame, and their names have to be remembered. What they did has to be remembered and sorted out and discussed, so that the living are fortified with the roots of the past, not by being sunk in the past, but by rescuing the past from those who would smother it to death. If you haven't heard enough about the 60s, I have to warn you, it's going to get worse and worse. Because starting in 2010, we'll begin the 50th anniversary of everything that ever happened in the 1960s. And every week there will be a fight over remembering or forgetting, moving on or not forgetting for a minute, for 10 years. And then hopefully those who have always wanted to make the 60s die anyway will get their wish indirectly, because all of us will die our natural death, and that will be the end of the fight for memory until a next generation. Thanks very much.
That was activist and author Tom Hayden speaking at a rally for the 16 students arrested at the University of British Columbia. The students were protesting a commercial development on campus on April 4, 2008. The evening with Tom Hayden was on July 3, 2008. A long question and answer period with some brilliant insights by Hayden followed. Meanwhile, find out more about Tom Hayden at tomhayden.com. Right now I'm on summer break as we play the best of Radio EcoShock. In the first week of September, I'll return with the whole new season of Radio EcoShock shows. With record heat waves around the world, strange 500-year floods, and creatures dying in the seas, in the hot seas, there is lots to talk about. Don't miss the top scientists, activists, and authors coming up next season. You can keep current with my Twitter feed, at EcoShock, on the Radio EcoShock Facebook page, or at our website at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. I'm Alex Smith. As always, I really appreciate you as a listener and supporter of a saner future. And this is the Canadian singer and activist Bruce Cockburn with When a Tree Falls.
Center for the world. Ancient court of coexistence hacked by a parasitic greenhead scam. From Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills, cortege rhythm of falling timber. What kind of currency grows in these new deserts? These brand new floodplains. Does anybody hear? If a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear? Anybody hear the forest fall? Move on. move on. Take out trees. Take out wildlife at a rate of a species every single day.
This is Jeff Blankford with the August 10th edition of Takes on the World, a program of international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Well, with the end of the Obama presidency just around the corner, discussions of his administration's foreign policy legacy are already well underway. But one central element of that policy has received little attention: the Obama administration's dramatic acceleration of U.S. weapons exports. Well, those were the words of William R. Tuttong, director of the Arms and Security Project for the Center on International Policy, with whom I'll be speaking at about 20 minutes past the hour. "The numbers are astonishing," wrote Hartung in an article last year, which was largely ignored. In President Obama's first 5 years in office, new agreements under the Pentagon's Foreign Military Sales, or FMS, program, the largest channel for U.S. arms exports, totaled over $169 billion. After adjusting for inflation, the volume of major deals concluded by the Obama administration in its first 5 years exceeds the amount approved by the Bush administration in its full 8 years in office by nearly $30 billion. That also means that the Obama administration has approved more arms sales than any U.S. administration since World War II. End quote from William Hartung. If the Nobel Committee ever gave a prize for sheer hypocrisy, Obama would clearly be the front runner. Now, it's something to think about when, after each bloody massacre on American soil, the president makes an appeal to end gun violence. I frequently feel obliged to mention on this program how Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose image President Obama often likes to invoke, accused the U.S. of being, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, a year before he was assassinated. We'll hear more from William Hartung how Dr. King's words became an integral part of the job description as well as the resume of the present resident of the White House. King's name came up the other day, used opportunistically, as it too often is, by spokespersons from the Jewish political establishment who are outraged by the decision by the Black Lives Matter movement to link its struggle for justice in the United States with the Palestinian resistance to Israeli apartheid and what it labeled as genocide. On more than one occasion, when asked to do so by Jewish leaders of his time, on whose financial support the civil rights movement relied, Dr. King expressed his support for Israel by saying, more than once, that, quote, the whole world must see that Israel must exist and has a right to exist and is one of the great outposts of democracy in this world, end quote. But after the Six-Day War in June 1967, he had second thoughts that he never made public and canceled a long-planned trip to Israel by the same Jewish leaders. In a conference call recorded on June 24, 1967, he told his advisors that some of what Israel had done he found troubling, quote, I'm damned if I say this and I'm damned if I say that, no matter what I'd say, complained King, and I've already faced enough criticism, including pro-Arab. I just think that if I go, the Arab world and, of course, Africa and Asia, for that matter, would interpret this as endorsing everything that Israel has done. I do have questions of doubt. Most of it, the pilgrimage, would be Jerusalem, and they, the Israelis, have annexed Jerusalem, and any way you say it, they don't plan to give it up. I frankly have to admit that my instincts, and when I follow my instincts, so to speak, I'm usually right, said Dr. King. I just think that this would be a great mistake, end quote. Those, again, were the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. telling his advisors in a conference call in 1967 why he decided not to visit Israel. For very practical reasons, with his, quote, eyes on the prize, here in the U.S., he was murdered long before he could have been expected to express his doubts about Israel in public. It would be insulting to his memory as well as ludicrous to believe that had King lived a half a century later, he would have maintained the same unqualified public support for Israel in the face of its treatment of the Palestinians and its barbaric wars on Lebanon and Gaza. The co-author of the Black Lives Matter platform passage that accused Israel of genocide defended the term, saying Israel's actions fit into its wider definition. Ben Aduga Kabui co-authored the statement with Rachel Gilmer, a former board member of a Zionist youth group. Nduga Kabui told the Jewish Telegraphic Agency he understood why Jewish groups disagree with the statement, but was perplexed that it has received so much attention. He compared it with the accusations of genocide that black activists had leveled at the United States and called the Israeli-Palestinian conflict one of many international conflicts to which U.S. black activists feel connected. The way we look at it, we take strong stances, said Nduga Kabui, a New York City organizer for the Black Alliance for Justice Immigration. The demand we're making is we're against the U.S. continuing funding and military aid to the government of Israel. These are all things that are going to be in debate, end quote. The platform released August 2nd by the Movement for Black Lives Coalition contains the goals of the movement that began with the murder of a young black man, Michael Brown, 2 years ago in Ferguson, Missouri, and that followed with the murder of other black men in New York and Baltimore. The platform also calls for ending U.S. military aid to Israel, accuses Israel of being an apartheid state, and includes a link to a website promoting the movement to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel called BDS, which the California legislature at this moment is deep in the Israel lobby's pocket as Congress is on the point of making illegal. The U.S. justifies and advances the global war on terror via its alliance with Israel and is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people, reads the Invest, Divest section of, quote, A Vision for Black Lives. By providing aid, the platform argues, the United States is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people, unquote. Criticizing the construction of Israeli settlements in the Palestinian West Bank and East Jerusalem and the rest of young Palestinians, it described Israel as, quote, an apartheid state. That's a position long advanced by a number of South African leaders such as Bishop Desmond Tutu, as well as Israeli critics of their country's racist policies. Mainstream Jewish organizations from across the country have, as would be expected, criticized that portion of the document while expressing their sympathy to other parts of the platform, many of which jibe with their liberal positions on the criminal justice system, economic justice, and immigration. The conflict is reminiscent of the break between the Jewish establishment in the civil rights era, who, together with a number of Jews in the anti-war movement, objected, as did Dr. King, to the more militant elements of the black liberation struggle who expressed their solidarity with the victims of Israel's 1967 war of conquest and their occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. It is an ironic twist that it was two members of the Congressional Black Caucus, Berkeley and Oakland's Barbara Lee and Baltimore's Elijah Cummings, who were instrumental in defeating platform planks at the Democratic Party convention introduced by Bernie Sanders supporters. They would have identified Israel's relations to the Palestinians as one of occupation and denounced the building of illegal Jewish settlements in the West Bank, both of which are long-established but unenforced U.S. positions on the conflict. They were also responsible for blocking a platform plank that would have had the party oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. Since Cummings and Lee were both picked for the platform committee by Hillary Clinton herself, we know what we can expect from her on all these issues once she is in the White House. Yes, she's going to show her contempt for her supporters and the public by again backing the TPP, which she once described as the gold standard of trade agreements. Well, given that even the mainstream media has acknowledged Clinton's outsized hawkishness, although too late to have an effect on the early primaries, a piece of news out of Tel Aviv offers a hint of what's to come in another Clinton administration, namely a renewal of the Cold War with Russia, if not the real thing. Defense News reported on Monday that Israel's state-owned Rafael Advanced Defense System and Raytheon, its U.S. partner for Iron Dome production, are working to transform the combat-proven Israeli interceptor into a fully American system in defense of forward-deployed U.S. forces. The Iron Dome project, you may recall, was the U.S. taxpayer-funded system which allowed Israel's military to shoot down incoming rockets from Gaza, most of which were homemade, that Israel used as an excuse for leveling much of the heavily populated Palestinian strip along the Mediterranean. Americanized versions of the Iron Dome's Tamir interceptors are being offered under the Raytheon trademarked Skyhunter brand for a U.S. Army program aimed at defending against a spectrum of threats from cruise missiles and UAVs to rockets, artillery, and mortars. The Israeli-designed Tamir interceptor has already been adapted for launch from the U.S. Army's Developmental Multi-Missile Launcher, MML, part of the service's Indirect Fire Protection Capability Increment 2, Intercept, IFPC INC-2-1 program. Did you get that? The Army has something called the Indirect Fire Protection Capability Incremental 2 Increment, or IFPC INC-2-1. Well, in an April IFPC program tested Army's White Sands missile range in New Mexico, the MML launched Tamir scored its first intercept on U.S. soil against a target drone. Israeli government and industry sources say half of U.S. production funds funneled into Israel's Iron Dome program in recent years is already going to Raytheon, which produces major components for the Rafael-designed Tamir interceptor in multiple facilities throughout the U.S. If selected for the Army's IFPC INC-2-1 program, the Tamir would be upgraded to U.S. standards, whatever those are, produced in the United States and rendered 100% Raytheon, said Yossi Druker, head of Rafael's Air Superiority System Division. To my astonishment, I suspect yours, I discovered that there are at least 43 Raytheon factories in as many states, plus Puerto Rico and the nation's capital. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein's run for the White House has attracted attention in the mainstream media in a way that Ralph Nader's efforts never did, and she has gained the backing of a number of Bernie Sanders supporters who remain disgusted at the way their candidate was treated by the Democratic National Convention and how they were treated at the Democrats' National Convention as well. Now she has come out against continuing U.S. military aid to Israel, a subject that has aroused sharp differences between the White House and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, not so much about the size of the package, apparently, but whether or not any of the proposed $45 billion or so, that's billion with a B, provided by U.S. taxpayers over a 10-year period, may be spent in Israel and not on the products of one of our patriotic weapons manufacturers. I am pleased to report, however, that a lawsuit has been filed in Washington that, if existing U.S. nonproliferation laws are enforced, admittedly not a given whenever Israel is concerned, the proposed aid package will be judged illegal. On Monday, a lawsuit was filed in the D.C. Federal District Court challenging U.S. foreign aid to Israel. The action was taken by Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy in Washington, who you have heard on Takes on the World, providing details on Israeli spying and Israeli smuggling of enriched uranium for its nuclear weapons program that you won't hear in any other radio program or read about in the mainstream media, very sad to say. And Grant Smith is doing something else that's unusual, so listen closely. Tomorrow, Thursday at 10 a.m. East Coast time, that's 7 a.m. in California, IRMEP's Center for Policy and Law will be holding a conference call briefing about the lawsuit, and you, yes, you, are invited to participate. To register online and receive the conference call phone number, access code, and briefing materials, you need to go to http://IRMEP, it's IRMEP.org/aid-lawsuit, one word, .htm. But I also found that there is a link simply at IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org, and you get a link to that conference call. Registration closes tonight at 6 p.m. California time. As I mentioned, the U.S. is finalizing a 10-year memorandum of understanding with Israel, which will reportedly boost aid to $4 to $5 billion per year. The suit challenges the authority of the president and the U.S. federal agencies to deliver such foreign aid to Israel on the basis that it violates longstanding bans on aid to non-signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, with nuclear weapons programs, like Israel. Since the bans went into effect, U.S. foreign aid to Israel is estimated to be $234 billion. The lawsuit reveals what Grant Smith has documented and discussed on this program, how in the mid-1970s, during investigations into the illegal diversion of weapons-grade uranium from the Pennsylvania-based U.S. contractor NUMEC to Israel, Senators Stuart Simonian and John Glenn amended the 1961 Foreign Assistance Act to ban any aid to clandestine nuclear powers that had not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Symington clarified the legislative intent of the amendment, saying, quote, "If you wish to take the dangerous and costly steps necessary to achieve a nuclear weapons option, you could not expect the United States to help underwrite that effort indirectly or directly," end quote, which is what U.S. has been doing for Israel. The Obama administration has followed precedents established since the Ford administration, ignoring internal agency and information in the public domain that should have triggered cutoffs based on the Symington and Glenn legislation and waiver provisions governing foreign aid. Moreover, Obama, who came to the White House promising greater transparency, went further in criminalizing the flow of such information from the federal government to the public. In 2012, the Department of Energy, under State Department authority, passed a secret gag law called, quote, "Guidance on Release of Information Relating to the Potential for an Israeli Nuclear Capability," end quote. The gag law and related measures, according to Smith, promote a nuclear ambiguity policy toward Israel. Its primary purpose, the suit alleges, is to unlawfully subvert the Symington and Glenn arms export controls. It may seem like a shot in the dark, but AIRMEP won an unprecedented release of a Pentagon report about Israel's nuclear weapons program through a 2014 lawsuit that the mainstream media conveniently ignored, and another lawsuit filed in 2015 that led to the dislodging of CIA files about the NUMEC-enriched uranium diversion. Again, if you want to join me and be part of a conference call discussing the suit to stop USA to Israel with Grant Smith tomorrow at 7 a.m. California time, you need to register today by 6 p.m. California time by going online to IRMEP.org. That's IRMEP.org, and clicking on the appropriate link. It's very easy. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who reflects on the 71st anniversary of the atomic bombs dropped by the U.S. on Japan in 1945, as America is poised to spend $1 trillion building a new generation of nuclear weapons. Longtime civil rights activist Bob Zellner, who talks about his work today with the Moral Mondays movement, which launched their Moral Revolution of Values tour across the U.S. in April. And 9/11 widow and activist Kristen Breitweiser, who discusses new information found in the recently declassified 28 pages of the Congressional September 11th inquiry, highlighting the links between the Saudi Arabian government and 9/11 hijackers. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the Olympic torch passed through the poor suburbs of Rio de Janeiro, police fired stun grenades and tear gas against protesters angry at the enormous cost of the Olympic Games. On full display were the same heavy-handed tactics used by security forces in Rio State that led to police killing 645 people in 2015. Thus far in 2016, over 300 have been killed by police in Greater Rio. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have long considered the Rio police among the most violent in the world, with charges that they often engage in extrajudicial executions. According to the Guardian newspaper, reform of the police department was undertaken during Brazil's boom times, which reduced the level of police violence by 60%, particularly in the impoverished favela neighborhoods. Yet police killings are now on the rise again in the wake of Brazil's current economic crisis and the effort to rein in drug gangs during the earlier 2014 World Cup and the current Olympic Games. A recent statement by Amnesty International reported a 103% spike in police killings in Rio over the last year. Brazil's Amnesty Director, Attila Roque, declared, "The seemingly unstoppable rise in killings by the police has hurt any chance of a positive Olympic legacy in the area of public safety." 30 years after scientists warned of a growing ozone hole in the Earth's atmosphere, there are signs the ozone layer is starting to recover. In 1987, global heads of state signed the Montreal Protocol, which phased out the production and use of ozone-destroying chemicals known as CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons, which had been used as a coolant. Optimism about the restoration of the ozone hole over Antarctica comes from new data released in late June showing the gap in the ozone layer had shrunk 1.5 million square miles since the year 2000. But progress is still fragile, noted lead researcher Susan Solomon of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She told the Christian Science Monitor that last year scientists observed the largest ozone hole ever. However, researchers soon realized the increase in the ozone hole was aggravated by the eruption of the Andean volcano Calbuco. Stratospheric ozone filters out most of the sun's potentially harmful shortwave ultraviolet radiation. When ozone is depleted, more UV rays reach the Earth. Exposure to high amounts of UV rays have serious impacts on human beings, animals, and plants, including more skin cancers, eye cataracts, and the weakening of the human immune system. 15 years ago, the Radical Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW, began organizing fast food workers at chains like Starbucks and Jimmy John's. At the time, mainstream labor leaders were baffled, given the high turnover of fast food workers, which made it extremely difficult to successfully organize these low-wage workers. Now, the movement for a $15 minimum wage is being led by fast food workers with support from major labor unions and politicians like Bernie Sanders and California Governor Jerry Brown. The IWW is now moving into its next cause, pushing the labor movement to rally behind the 400,000 Americans toiling behind bars in prison labor. This week, the IWW and affiliated groups organized prison labor strikes in states including Alabama, Texas, Missouri, and Ohio. The union has called for a national strike on September the 9th to mark the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising. According to the online Payday report, labor advocates assert inmates have the right to organize under the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board to negotiate over issues like wages and work hours. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The people of Japan solemnly gathered again this year on August 6th and 9th to mark the death and destruction wrought by the U.S. dropping of atomic bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 that effectively ended World War II. This first, second, and only use of nuclear weapons in war killed an estimated 140,000 people in Hiroshima and 70,000 in the port city of Nagasaki. While President Barack Obama's historic visit to Hiroshima on May 27th, the first by a sitting U.S. president, was a gesture appreciated by many in Japan. Recent comments by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump about nuclear weapons has caused distress and anxiety. The GOP candidate, known for his off-the-cuff remarks and a constant stream of factually inaccurate statements, suggested in March that Japan and South Korea should develop their own nuclear arsenal. He also asked why U.S. military commanders haven't used nuclear weapons since 1945, while refusing to rule out an American nuclear attack in Europe. As Americans prepare to choose their next president in November, the Obama administration and Pentagon plan to spend $1 trillion to modernize America's nuclear arsenal, including aircraft and submarines over the next 3 decades, has emerged as an important issue. Prominent scholars and activists have called on Mr. Obama in recent months to make good on his 2009 pledge in Prague to move the world toward nuclear disarmament during his remaining months in office. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, political and communications director with Peace Action, who was reached in Japan, where he was attending ceremonies commemorating the 1945 atomic bomb attack. Here, Martin discusses the steps that could be taken by the president to reduce the likelihood that nuclear weapons will ever be used again.
There's a little bit of disbelief here, especially on the heels of our current president, Obama, who, you know, within the first year of his presidency, was the first president to say he wanted to see a world free of nuclear weapons, and ended up taking some minor steps in that direction, including negotiating of the New START Treaty, which cut our nuclear arsenals by 10% with Russia, some nuclear security summits, several of those that he put together to secure nuclear materials, and even changing a little bit of the language that we would never use nuclear weapons on a non-nuclear state. And then lastly, his visit to Hiroshima, which was historic, that happened a couple of months ago. So when they're looking at a next president, one who seems to throw around, let's nuke them or nuke him, you know, just like it's a slap in the face and not taking nuclear weapons seriously, and nuclear weapons in which scientists say if several were used at once could actually end humanity as we know it because of something called nuclear winter, the dust created from several nuclear weapons could block out the sun and actually change or end human life as we know it. To joke around and use it so freely and clearly not to understand that there was another report where Trump kept saying, why can't we just use nuclear weapons? Why can't we just use nuclear weapons? So clearly a misunderstanding of the power of nuclear weapons and why we should never use it again. You can contrast that to Hillary Clinton, who was head of the State Department, Secretary of State, during the time in which we negotiated the New START Treaty with Russia. So that's clearly a positive thing. She hasn't come out as strongly as President Obama in her language, in which she says, in some century, we should get rid of these weapons altogether. But nonetheless, it seems like she has a better understanding on the power and destruction of these weapons that really should never be used again.
Paul, as we mark the 71st anniversary of the dropping of the U.S. nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, President Obama sits in office, and despite his earlier pledges to work towards nuclear disarmament in the world, it looks like the United States is on track to spend $1 trillion over the next 3 decades modernizing the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. There is growing opposition to this idea of spending this enormous amount of money, and of course, the concern about the destabilizing effect of a whole new generation of nuclear weapons in the United States and what that would trigger in other countries.
Yes, so the president has made some minor steps forward, as I mentioned before, with the START Treaty, but as he has reduced the number of nuclear weapons the least of any post-Cold War president. So he certainly has a long several steps to go, I think, to live up to his speech that he made in Prague about ridding the world of nuclear weapons, and his Nobel Peace Prize, which for the most part was given because of his pledge against nuclear weapons and his pledge to remove troops out of Iraq. So one of the things that he did, and our understanding is actually regretful and doesn't think it's actually been interpreted quite the way he thought, is part of the way he got the START Treaty passed through the Senate, which needed to be ratified, was an agreement to keep funding of some of the nuclear weapons systems. But the current funding, as you mentioned, to upgrade all of our warheads and the delivery systems, so that's bombers, missiles, and submarines, is going to cost $1 trillion over the next 30 years. And that's really something we can't afford. I mean, there's people even in the Defense Department and government, this is a bipartisan issue in which they're looking at these costs at a time where we're supposedly moving towards less nuclear weapons, and we're going to spend all this money to refurbish the systems. It just doesn't make sense. And as you mentioned, some of these weapons can be very destabilizing. So one of the ones that's been put forth is something called the long-range standoff missile, which is basically a new nuclear cruise missile. This cruise missile, if it was launched at someone, you would not be able to tell if it's a nuclear cruise missile or a regular cruise missile. So if we end up putting this weapon together, then any country who sees a cruise missile coming from anywhere couldn't assume that it's not a nuclear weapon, and it could cause an accidental nuclear war. It also, as you mentioned, could cause buildup, specifically in China, maybe North Korea, and other countries. So we're hoping in the next 5 months of the president's term that we will see a couple of steps in that direction, some that are being pushed or something called a no first use policy, which will say we would never use nuclear weapons first. We have several thousand weapons in reserve, and we could say that we are going to dismantle a certain portion of those. We could move from our 1,500 strategic warheads and say we're going to unilaterally move down to 1,000, which the Department of Defense says we could easily do. And there's a number of other steps that we could do to move the ball forward and try to keep our pledge in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which says that we will be moving towards disarmament.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, Political and Communications Director with Peace Action. Learn more about the steps President Obama could take to move toward nuclear disarmament by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Reverend Dr. William Barber, president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, is a nationally known human rights leader. At the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, he endorsed Hillary Clinton and explained why he was troubled by the way faith is cynically used by some to serve hate, fear, racism, and greed. Barber is now on a revival tour, speaking in some 20 states, preaching the gospel of a moral revolution of values in response to racism, sexism, economic inequality, and attacks on the LGBT community. One member of Reverend Barber's revival team is Bob Zellner, who was the first white Southerner to become a community organizer with one of the most important civil rights groups of the 1960s, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Zellner, the grandson and son of members of the Ku Klux Klan, began his activism as a freedom writer in 1961 as SNCC's field secretary. He traveled from Atlanta to Albany, Georgia, to test two U.S. Supreme Court decisions that outlawed the segregation of interstate travel facilities and was arrested 18 times in 7 states. Many SNCC organizers risked their lives traveling to the most dangerous areas of the South to help black citizens register to vote. Bob Zellner, now 76, currently works with the North Carolina NAACP, where he trains activists in the SNCC form of community organizing. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Zellner about what he sees as today's key human rights struggles and how they can be won.
As one who did fight 50 years ago in the South to end a kind of a deliberate violence, state-sponsored violence, and it was supported by a lot of vigilante action as well. And we're faced today with the same situation. In the 50s, we were working in the worst parts of the United States to try to do away with the terror of lynching and castration. And in today, we have a situation now with the wealth having been so severely redirected upward that we have whole classes of people now being oppressed. And the police are needed now more than they have been, say, in the last 20 or 30 years because there's a lot of unrest, and police are generally used to keep labor strife down and keep people in line. And it's the difficult thing we're faced with now is that reforms, tiny reforms like having prosecutors not prosecute their own police, that would be a very difficult thing to get done. So I think what's on the agenda now is a thoroughgoing moral and a revolution of values in this country, the kind that Dr. King was talking about in the Poor People's Campaign 50 years ago. We're rejuvenating that campaign now with Reverend Barber and the people at Union Theological Seminary in New York to try to get people together across class lines, across race lines, obliterate all these lines between people so we can get people power back. We've given up a lot of our democracy.
Bob Zellner, it sounds like you're articulating mostly a class analysis, but I wonder where race fits in, and particularly what you think of the Black Lives Matter movement, especially with your background in fighting for civil rights over the past 50 years.
Yes, it's specifically related to Black Lives Matter, and the reason that's an important emphasis is that when we have such deeply ingrained racism in this country, Black Lives Matter have to be emphasized because they've become so cheap and overlooked that all lives begin not to matter very much. And our slogan now is that all lives won't matter until Black Lives Matter. So it is a specific problem, and race is so at the center of this police violence that we have to pay attention to that especially because that's basically the motivation for people to give up their rights. And the Trump movement and the Tea Party movement asks white working people to give up their economic well-being in exchange for being racially superior. So the race is used as an economic bludgeon against even the white working class.
That is a really interesting way to put it. It seems to kind of address the whole split between those who say Black Lives Matter and those who insist all lives matter. One last question. During this crazy election season, your movement is supporting Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Reverend Barber actually endorsed her when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention. I just wonder if taking sides like that limits your outreach or your effectiveness, and if it might be better to maintain your neutrality.
Well, as NAACP people, we have to be nonpartisan, but as human beings, we know that we're in a struggle now, so that we have to support one or the other of the establishment candidates. Well, we have an establishment candidate and an anti-establishment candidate, and in this case, we have to support the establishment candidate, Hillary, even though we have a lot of disagreements, because the alternative is just like Germany, because if you mobilize the white working class on the basis of their whiteness, it's going to be a white nationalism or white supremacist movement that's gotten us into a fix that we're in already. We have to jettison that and go with a kind of unity organizing. And the election campaign, we see it as a way of organizing, not as an end in itself. And I'm very concerned about people who are ultra-left or ultra-pure, especially in swing states like my state of North Carolina. Well, we have to get out and vote, and we have to vote in this case for the Democratic candidate because the alternative is going to open up our country to further destruction of the democratic process that we used to have. We're probably under an oligarchy now, but we will definitely be under if this crazy man is able to win.
That was Bob Zellner, former SNCC field secretary, who now works with the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. His memoir, published in 2008, is titled The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Movement. Learn more about the Moral Mondays movement and Bob Zellner by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After more than 13 years of withholding 28 pages of classified documents that were part of the congressional inquiry into the September 11th al-Qaeda attacks on America that killed 3,000 people in New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania, U.S. intelligence officials released those pages on July 15th. Although redactions totaled more than 3 pages of the original 29, the documents feature new details about the alleged links between the 19 September 11th hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabian citizens, and the Saudi government. Analysis of the documents found that two of the hijackers were in contact with and received support or assistance from individuals who may be connected to the Saudi government. News outlets examining the declassified pages found a link between an alleged al-Qaeda operative and a company associated with a key member of the Saudi royal family, former Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest maintained that the now declassified pages doesn't change the assessment of the U.S. government, that there's no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi officials individually funded al-Qaeda. However, activists and members of some 9/11 victims' families continue to demand an independent investigation into links they maintain exist between the Saudi government and the hijackers, the release of additional documents, and accountability for those implicated. Your reporter spoke with Kristen Breitweiser, a September 11th widow and activist working with a group of other 9/11 widows known as the Jersey Girls. Here she reviews new information found in the declassified 28 pages of the Congressional 9/11 inquiry.
What we found out is that, first and foremost, the government was not exactly forthright with the American public. They kept 29 pages secret from us because it was inconvenient, it was embarrassing, and it was an uncomfortable situation because, for a bunch of reasons, the United States wants to continue this unhealthy relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The second thing that you need to realize is that because this information was withheld for so long, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was never held accountable. The 29 pages reveal in very clear detail funding of various hijackers, operational support, financial support of the hijackers. It mentions a Saudi ambassador who provided an enormous amount of support. It mentions a terrorist named Abu Zubaydah, who was captured overseas and who had that particular ambassador's phone number in his pocket. So you see, there were some glaring problems in the 29 pages that showed clearly that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, its officials, and some of its royal family were not our allies. They, in fact, facilitated, in many ways, the 9/11 attacks. So it's frustrating for the 9/11 families to read this information so many years later, to know that the kingdom is still not being held accountable, to know that even President Obama, you know, not exactly being honest with the American public and wants to continue this in what we would consider an unhealthy relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
So, Kristen, CIA Director John Brennan has said there's really no evidence that the Saudi government was directly involved in the 9/11 attack. And you often hear officials who make that declaration say that there may have been actors, citizens, or people in the monarchy in Saudi Arabia who may have been involved in terrorism. And certainly there's evidence over the years that that's true. But they declare that there's no official government involvement.
I don't really know how much higher you get with government involvement than, you know, the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, or his wife. And furthermore, what you need to understand is that not just the funding of the 9/11 hijackers, but funding of terrorist groups in general through the charities that are directly related to the Saudi government. What you need to understand is charities in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia don't work the way charities work in the U.S. Charities in Saudi Arabia are government charities. It's the government running those charities. And the government knows fully well what they're doing when they're handing over money to groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. And those groups are hell-bent on killing Americans. And, you know, you're seeing the results of that this very day around the world when you have ISIS carrying out attacks, whether they're in Belgium, Paris, San Bernardino, Orlando, Nice, wherever. And I personally feel the reason why those attacks are still occurring is because the Saudis have never been held accountable. There's no denying the fact that if you dry up terrorist funding, groups like ISIS can't kill people. You know, they need money to operate. They need money to run their websites. They need money to buy plane tickets to fly to places like Nice and Paris and Belgium. They need money to teach people how to build bombs and have training camps. And when you cut off that funding, when you stop enabling them to preach the hate that they're doing to kill the infidels, you know, the terrorist attacks are going to stop. And it's not a panacea. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it's certainly hitting terrorism at the root. And what boggles my mind is why the U.S. government is so unwilling to hold the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia accountable.
That was Kristen Breitweiser, a September 11th widow and activist. She's the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. Find links to the declassified documents and Kristen's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Old Baltimore Blues. The brilliant and beautiful Nina Simone, in her classic lament, Baltimore, sings of a city by the sea, but one that she longs to flee from because of its hardness and its meanness. In her unforgettable refrain, she mixes her love of the city with her longing to go elsewhere, singing, "Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to leave, just to live?" Simone's deep, rich contralto flew to mind when I heard of the government's report on the city's roguish police department, one seemingly bent on making the lives of black Baltimoreans as miserable as possible. According to the report released by the Department of Justice, local cops routinely violated the constitutional rights of blacks and also used excessive force against him, largely with impunity. According to a high-ranking DOJ official, cops not only stopped and frisked thousands of people in an unconstitutional manner, they beat people. They punished demonstrators engaged in First Amendment actions. They falsely arrested people. And most shockingly, they stripped people naked in the streets in blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment governing search and seizure. And they did all of these things in Baltimore's low-income and black communities. And they did this for years, for decades. Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to live, just to live. Baltimore is more than a southern city. It's a majority black city with a 64% African-American inhabitants. It has a black mayor, black DA, and until recently, a black police chief. What difference did it make? To tens of thousands of black Baltimoreans, it didn't mean a damn thing. Nothing. Black politicians buried their heads in the sand while the people they claimed to represent were subjected to a sustained campaign of harassment, humiliation, violence, and terror. Only the fires that burned Baltimore after the police murder of Freddie Gray brought light to a situation of mass unconstitutional behavior by the BPD. And you better know, it ain't just Baltimore. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Donald J. Trump as the poll star of the Republican Party has much to do with his penchant for outrageous comments, but it has much more to do with the media's need to sell soap and make money. Never before has the nation seen such numbers tuning in to view a political debate. Trump, as a reality TV star, is right at home on TV. His unpredictable style made his appearances must-see TV. The media ate it up, literally. Bigger audiences meant higher advertisement rates and bigger bonuses. The media gave this billionaire billions of dollars of free airtime. While his opponents spent millions, Trump spent pennies. He still got wall-to-wall coverage. And he got bigger and meaner and more Trumpish. The media made him. Later, they began to unmake him. We are now watching the media destruction of Trump. They have circled the proverbial media wagons against him. Every word, every utterance, every inkling is picked apart, even if Trump isn't helping the matter. The media made money pumping up Trump. Now they're making money pulling him apart. I've written about the Clinton show. We are all now witnessing the Trump show. But this is the real reality show. And it seems to be coming to an end. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Transformation by Assata Shakur. I believe in living. I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people. I believe in sunshine, in windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees. I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes. I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth, sculpting mud bodies in its path. I have seen the destruction of the daylight and seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind and the blind become the bind in one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference. I have been locked by the lawless, and if I know anything at all, it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all. It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth. I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship steered by tired seasick sailors can still be guided home to port. Affirmation. By Assata Shakur. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Imperial feminine. If democratic hopes are fulfilled, Hillary Rodham Clinton will shortly become the 45th president of the United States, the first of the female gender to do so. While that is indeed remarkable, it should be noted that the majority of America's population is female, which shows us just how undemocratic the U.S. political system really is. The brilliant wife of America's second president, Abigail Adams, wife of John, implored him to, in her words, remember the ladies. He, like most husbands, ignored her, and almost two centuries would pass before women got the vote. But the world has had its share of female leaders, and striving to outrun their male counterparts, many a woman leader has unleashed the dogs of war, from Cleopatra of Ptolemaic Egypt to queens of England. In the modern era, Golda Meir of Israel, Indira Gandhi of India, and Margaret Thatcher of Britain played the bloody game once regarded as the sport of kings. Meir waged war against Arabs. Thatcher unleashed her troops against Argentina over the Falkland Malvinas Isles. And Gandhi ordered an internal war against the Sikhs, shattering their holiest shrine, the Golden Temple of Amritsar. Females in positions of power must assume a hyper-masculine, muscular, martial stance. They do this to prove they are, after all, one of the boys. And Hillary Rodham Clinton is truly just one of the boys. While a senator, she voted for the Iraq War, regarded by most foreign policy experts as the nation's worst foreign blunder. She prevailed as Secretary of State to destabilize Libya and sent arms to anti-Gaddafi Islamists. Libya today is a smoldering charnel house. Neoliberals like her are so martial, so military-centered, that her primary opponent, the manic Donald Trump, a Republican, calls her, I kid you not, a warmonger. Worse still, he's right. As Hillary Clinton ascends to the imperial throne, it is her decision-making, not her gender, that is in question. Women once ruled the world. They may do so again. Let them rule with wisdom, compassion, and mercy, and not in pantsuits, clamoring with a game of death to just be one of the boys. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Really glad to be here today, and I've been looking forward to this show for quite a while now. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear, why are we still fighting for justice in 2015? Now, this is a segment from the DVD Revolutionary Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian that took place in late 2014 at Riverside Church in New York City. And this was after the police murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, but before the grand jury refused to indict the cop who murdered him. It was also in the aftermath of the military-style raids on housing projects in Harlem when the NYPD rounded up dozens of black youth for being black youth, okay? And here's the situation, sisters and brothers. Tell me that you aren't thinking about this every time you see one of these horrors come down in society. You're not asking yourself the question, why the hell are we still in this time, 2015 then, 2016 now, why is it that we still have to fight for basic justice and to stop incredible, horrible, murderous injustice? Let's listen to this and let's make this a discussion for every one of us to be taking part in. And opening the show up is something that I've wanted to do for quite some time. I'm going to be having a conversation with an artist that I've known for a number of years now. His name is Dred Scott. And Dred Scott is a revolutionary artist who's been creating inspiring, beautiful, and very provocative works of art for decades. Some of his works, including A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday, were recently included in a show called For Freedoms in New York City. And it, as much of his work does, it generated a lot of controversy. Also cracked open a lot of heads in terms of opening up and inspiring a lot of thinking, discussion, struggle, and new ways of looking at things. And I'm very pleased to have him on for quite some time during this show. Dred, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking.
Yeah, me too, man. So we're going to jump into it. And you can be expansive, brother, because I want to hear everything you have to say, okay? Your latest work, A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday, 2013. It's part of what I said, like a part of a show in New York called For Freedoms. Tell people about this piece.
Okay, well, first off, it's 2015.
Okay.
And it's actually really kind of simple. I mean, it's a large black flag with large white text that says, a man was lynched by police yesterday. And it is an unfortunately necessary update on a flag that the NAACP used to fly in the 20s and 30s. They flew it from their national headquarters, and their flag said a man was lynched yesterday. And they were organizing what they called an anti-lynching campaign. Lynching was a scourge from the Jim Crow era, which, you know, we can talk more about later. But the short part is they wanted to stop this, and lynching was a very public form of terror that was unleashed against the black community. And they were organizing people to stop it. So their office is in New York. They put this flag out the day after anybody was lynched. It was very provocative at the time, and it drew a lot of people to be inspired by it. But also the landlord of the building said, look, man, you guys can't put that out. After a while, they were threatened that they wouldn't have their lease renewed. So I knew about this, you know, flag. There were, you know, images in the Library of Congress, and it's kind of been circulating in the movement for a bit. There's a really wonderful artist named Terry Atkins who used to use it in some of his performances. And I said, look, this needs to be updated because the police are playing the same role of lynch mob terror as lynch mobs did, you know, in the 20s and 30s and 10s. And So I made this work after Walter Scott got killed. Walter Scott was stopped for a traffic violation and fled for his life in Charleston, South Carolina, or I think South Charleston, South Carolina, in 2015. And it's just, if somebody didn't have the courage to videotape that, you wouldn't have seen this cop cold-bloodedly shoot a man in the back, I mean, who was, 30 or 40 yards from him. But we did see that. Everybody saw that, and I felt I had to act. So I made this flag at the time. And then, it was shown at a gallery in Iowa City, which was great. And then it sat in my studio. And then when Alton Sterling and Philando Castile got killed by the police, and everybody saw the videos, we witnessed, a four-year-old girl trying to comfort her mother as her mother's boyfriend bleeds to death in the car seat next to her after having been shot by a cop. And, it was just, enough. And people really felt this. And so I was in this show called Four Freedoms, which we can, talk about more about what that is. And I called up I sent an email to Hank Willis Thomas, who's one of the organizers of the show, and said, look, I know this is like unusual, but can we add an extra work? The show was already up. And, it's at a commercial gallery called Jack Shainman Gallery, which is a really beloved gallery in New York City that shows some very, very well-known and well-respected artists. And I said, look, can we add this? I know it's not done. And I expected the answer to be no, because, people don't change gallery shows once they're up. But their answer was, how quickly can you get down here? Hop a cab, we'll put it up today, which is the right answer. That was really, really welcome. And so it then became a bit of a phenomenon. People started putting it on Instagram, tweeting about it. And we also took it down to a demonstration that was happening that day for Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, and then came back to the gallery and installed it. And then it did generate mostly a lot of love and interest and support, but then Fox News decided to jump into it and attack the work, which then meant the gallery is getting threats. And then the landlord, mirroring that history from the 30s, decided to side with the modern-day lynchers and said, get this off the wall, citing a legal technicality, and forced the gallery to take it from the outside where they had proudly and prominently displayed it and forced it to the inside of their space.
Damn, man. One of the things that I think actually, it's interesting because you wonder, what would they have said if it hadn't had that change in it by police?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little, because that's something that you really hit at a lot, that there is very much this organic connection between what was going on through the Klan, the white yahoos, all this other stuff, the racist assaults on black people, the question of slavery, everything else, and the role of the police today. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, first off, the piece would have been good if it was somebody just made a flag that said a man was lynched yesterday. That would have actually been really a good thing. But, a lot of my work deals with how history not only sets the stage for the present, but also exists in the present in new form. And by and large, black people are not being killed by lynch mobs today. It's like, fortunately, that's something that people say that's the past. And talking more about lynching was very public. I believe it's 1948 was the first year that there was not a public lynching since 1865. That happened in the United States. And so lynchings, sometimes there, were just a crowd of like a dozen or so white people, but often these were advertised in the newspapers, and people, sometimes 20,000 people would come from out of town to see somebody get lynched. And then they would take photographs and make postcards both as memorials of what white people, for white people that were there and they participated, but also to send as sort of warnings to black people in surrounding towns of how they would be treated. And part of the NAACP's campaign was to actually stop these sort of terroristic postcards from being sent through the mail service in the 30s. Not only that, people, at these lynchings, body parts were cut off. You'd go to your local deli or convenience store, and there'd be, a pickled finger sitting in a jar. This is how public and how much sort of white people in these towns were invested in this. Imagine living in a society where that is what's sort of setting the terms, where black people are basically know their place at point of death, and where white people, even if they aren't themselves frothing at the mouth racists, are like, yeah, this is what happens in my town, and there is not a visible opposition to it. Well, that was much of America up through, the 60s, actually. And so my work, added the words by police, because the thing is that you can see, go online, look at the Library of Congress, look at other places. There is, a book that I have, I forget the name of it, I think it's called Witness, which is about lynching photographs. And you can see all these picture after picture after picture with crowds of white people smiling as a black man is either on fire or strung up or being tortured or about to be tortured. These were things that there were photographic evidence taken. Everybody knew who the lynchers were, and rarely did they ever go to trial. And on the rare case that they went to trial, they were always acquitted, as in the case of, you know, Emmett Till, who everybody in that town knew who the lynchers were. And the lynchers then, after the trial, after they got acquitted by a jury of their peers, they went and laughed about it. They sold the story to Life magazine. And so everybody knew who the guilty were, but nobody actually was ever punished for it. And that's like the cops today. And a real example of that is the Freddie Gray trial. Freddie Gray was a perfectly healthy young man before he encountered the police in Baltimore. He gets captured by the police. There's video of it, of him screaming in pain. He's thrown in the back, hogtied in the back of a police van, and then he's dead a week later. And the only people who had contact with him were the police. After four trials, not a single cop was found guilty, and the other cops were then just let off because the prosecutor said, I can't try these cops. It's just like lynching. And for all black people, unlike, you know, like in the you know, 10s and 20s and 30s and 40s, everyone knew that for any reason or no reason whatsoever, they could be lynched. A pissed off white person that's a black guy owns property, or you didn't step off the sidewalk quickly enough when a black, white woman walks down, or you whistled at a white woman, or you joined a union. Any of those would be excuse to be killed by, through lynching. And nowadays, you know, black people are getting choked to death on video, tasered to death, shot in the back while handcuffed. You know, we can go on and on, you know, reaching to hand the cop your wallet when he asks you to hand him your wallet and you're sitting in a car. Everybody knows. There's been video after video after video after video of these cops shooting and murdering and choking death and tasing to death people, and they always get off. And so that's how what people think of as an abomination or a scourge from the past really exists in the present. But the other thing that this work is actually hitting at that exists in the present, and it's sort of more embryonic, but it needs to grow, the NAACP flag was used to organize people to stop this. And there's a movement of people that are standing up, that are shutting down traffic, that are, you know, in the face of the police, in the face of the authorities, demanding that black people be treated as human beings. And that needs to grow and foster in this flag, both as artwork, but then as sort of it's become more embraced beyond just art in a gallery, needs to be and is part of that.
Let's talk about that, because that was actually the next thing I was going to ask you. Is it really did become, from what I've read, it really did become, the flag was an act of defiance, and it was also a rallying call. You've mentioned that in other places where you've talked to people about it, and that there was actually a very heartfelt and great response on the part of a lot of people to this whole piece. Can you talk about that just a little?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the response was overwhelmingly positive. I mean, from the moment it went up, people started engaging this and expanding the conversation. I mean, first it began, we went down to the, well, actually, it actually began at the gallery. So when we're measuring it to install it, the gallery, you know, director takes a couple pictures and posts it on her Instagram and tweets about it. And then people pick that up. And people, it's a place that's actually visible from what's called the High Line. And the High Line is an old disused railroad that just is a public park now. And people could see us like measuring this and they were like, what is this? What's going on? And then they started taking pictures and those started percolating through the internet. And then, you know, but people like, there's a guy named Klaus Biesenbach, who's the curator at large of the Museum of Modern Art. He put it on his Instagram feed, which, I mean, he has like 200,000 followers or something. Other people started doing it. When we went down the demonstration, people wanted to be photographed with this. And they wanted to know, what is this about? What, you know, what is this? And a lot of people knew, but also people didn't. And, you know, as an example, there was a young woman who I met who was traveling out of the country before, you know, for the couple days prior, and she sort of stumbled upon the demonstration. And, you know, she was probably about 20 years old, and she came and wanted to know what the flag was. And then when I told her about the killing of Castile and Sterling, she broke down into tears. You know, the flag was a point of discussion, but then it actually resonated so deeply with people and the situation and the heaviness of it. And then this is something that's, I mean, there have been articles in, you know, all sorts of different places, you know, design magazines, fashion magazines. The New York Times wrote three separate articles that included discussion of it, and one of them was an art review, which is great. But the main and really, really excellent story was by somebody who typically writes about fashion, and she wrote a very, you know, moving piece that talked about the art that existed in response to recent police killings. And it's a very good piece that gets at the emotion of it and how people are, you know, how artists are responding, but how this is touching with people. It's been talked about in New York Magazine. It's been, you know, a lot of places, you know, art auction sites have talked about this. It's mostly been in arts and culture magazines, but it is much broader than that, and it ranges from mainstream publications, to sort of radical publications like Revolution Newspaper, to people just tweeting it, individuals seeing it, not knowing much about it, and saying this is something that the movement needs to engage, or my people need to engage, however they define my people. I don't mean it narrowly, but the followers, they're 50 followers or 100 followers on Twitter or Instagram or Tumblr or whatever.
One of the things that really gets me too is that part of this is not just put out as sort of like, look, this is an isolated phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that it's peculiar to the police and the bad police in New York City or the bad police in South Carolina or wherever, But you actually – and this is interesting because I was talking to somebody a little while ago about, I remember a piece that you did and you and I went out to see, and it was inspired by James Byrd Jr., who was, pulled to pieces by a truck driven by a bunch of racist yahoos, in Texas. And it was sort of – it was a huge – I mean, it was really such a remarkably heavy piece for me when I went through that. And I kept thinking at the time that a lot of your work and in particular a lot of the stuff that you do about Black youth, it really focuses on that there is a genocidal program that's in effect right now in this country, and it's aimed at Black people. Let's talk about that in your work.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. There is a genocidal program, and people have been talking about this for years, but the more people get into it, and it is provocative to say, because when people think of genocide, they think of, the Holocaust, killing of Jews, that was a horror. Or some people say, well, there was a genocide, a Black Holocaust, the transatlantic, the Middle Passage. But a lot of people don't think of what's going on right now as a genocide, and I think that thinking of it as sort of as a slow genocide that could become a fast genocide is kind of – genocides don't always happen all at once where you get 12 million people killed off or 6 million people killed off in a five-year period. They can happen sort of where there's a buildup and a demonization, and that's what's going on right now. What kind of society do you have where government officials can kill people on film that were unarmed, that are doing nothing wrong, that are not doing anything illegal, and that is actually sanctioned over and over and over and over again? I think that tells people a lot. And so when scholars start to look at what's going on, they're actually coming to a conclusion. People from Carl Dix to Michelle Alexander saying, look, this really is a genocidal program. And I don't think people have to, hype that, but just look at what's going on. And I think that the alarm bells should really be going off. And, just looking at the moment we're in, where there, one of the two presidential candidates has called for people to be beaten up during his rally. It's a fascist program that's in effect. And, this is a man who took out, full-page ads calling for the death penalty to be reinstated to kill five innocent people in the Central Park Five and then his counterpart, her husband is part of warehousing and doubling the prison population when Bill Clinton was in office. So, from the very top levels of this society, the ruling officials are all about bolting into place a genocidal program, some with more fangs, and the other with a much more slow road to the death camps. But it is something that's very bracing. As an artist, I've made a lot of work about, how the state is responding to the people, particularly Black people. What does it mean for youth to be criminalized? What does it mean for people to be warehoused in prisons? And talking to people that are being directly affected with it, talking with prisoners, talking with youth that are, stopped and picked up by the police 5 times, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times, 200 times during their lifetime, from age 16 to 20 or something like that, for just sitting around in their neighborhood and talking with them to learn what is happening to them, but what that says about this society, and then involving them to the degree possible in making art and other forms of sort of fighting against this, getting people to understand the enormity and dangerousness of the problem. And often that there's actually a solution, that people can make revolution and end this system. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with revolutionary artist Dred Scott. And we're talking about many of his amazing works, including one of his most recent, A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday. One of the things I kept thinking as you're speaking, it's sort of from the very beginning of your emergence into a national scene where you had – you know, way back when. Now, scratch your head to remember that, right? I know you'll never forget it. What's the proper way to display an American flag, which immediately brought hordes of frothing reactionaries chasing after you and every public venue they could find, marches of thousands of reactionaries in the streets because you actually challenged people to actually – your piece challenged people to – how are they going to react to the American flag? How are they going to actually – were people going to stand on it? Were they going to go out of their way to walk around it, to look at the thing, where they to write their comments or whatever? And the comments you got went from frothing to really supportive. And it really broke some things open in a big way. And your work continues to do that today. And I was thinking in particular of some questions around this point about genocide. And one of the things that struck me, and it was a very simple thing, was – the series of wanted posters you did.
Mm.
And I'd like you to tell people about them, what they were and what you did with them, because it's really, I mean, it's head snapping.
Yeah. Well, Wanted is a project. It's a community engaged project. So most of my work shows in galleries and museums. That's, you know, most of where I show work. But I have consistently over time also done stuff with various people, you know, community people and activists and organizers, and stuff that appears in the streets and in various ways. And so Wanted was a multi-layered project that masquerades, it pretends it's wanted posters, but these are wanted posters for things that are actually not illegal, that the youth get jacked up for and stopped by the police all the time. And so it had several components. One was me working with a core of about a dozen youth for about, I guess, 8 weeks to talk about their experience and to make art about this. As part of that, I also worked with sort of activists, community activists and organizers in the Stop Mass Incarceration Network who were working in the neighborhood where this project was taking place, which is in Harlem, which is where these youth were from. And these were all youth about 16 to 19 years old, and they all had some experience with the police just stopping them all the time and hassling them and harassing them. And so we had meetings, we had town hall meetings and community forum, and often what would happen was these youth would tell their stories, and sometimes their parents would be there, and their parents, you know, would kind of know on a theoretical level what stop and frisk is like, but they wouldn't know and understand how directly it's affecting their kids. And so the kids were speaking to, you know, a room full of people, maybe, you know, 50 people or something like that, and then some of the community organizers, these revolutionaries, radical activists, would then come and talk about, well, look, you got to look back to Rodney King. You got to look back to Emmett Till. It's not just you getting stopped, but here's how this exists both in the past, but also now, where the police have warehoused. You know, there are 2.3 million people in prison. Most of them are Black and Latino. And you have to look at the police murder, where there's over 1,100 people killed by the police. You got to look at the fact that the police in New York City stopped. In 2012, they stopped basically more Black youth than there were Black youth in the city of New York for stop and frisk. So they were putting these individual youth's experience in context. So there were these public forums, there were these town halls. Then there were meetings where the youth had volunteered because they said, look, we're walking around with a target on our back. And so if we're going to do some wanted posters, it should be of us. And I talked with them and said, look, if you have a wanted poster with your face on it, it might mean that you get stressed and hassled by the cops a lot more. Do you want to do that? And I talk with them about, like, look, you know, you could be like, you know, freedom riders. It's like, did they know what they were going to get into before they got on those buses? Probably not. But that them getting on those buses actually was part of changing history, and they were on the right side of history. And so it was a very courageous thing that youth back in the 60s did. And so these youth could play a similar role today. And are they up for it? And so, you know, I talked with them and they said, yes, hell yes, we've got a target on our back. We want to fight this. And so they volunteered to have their faces drawn on some of these posters. And I had those youth and the adults, who five of them had volunteered to give descriptions to a police sketch artist the next day. And so the adults saw these youth, and then the next day they met with a police sketch artist and gave descriptions. And so this police sketch artist, who was trained at doing this, he's no longer a cop. He gave that up 20 years before, but he was trained in talking with people about something they saw, someone they saw, which is a rare art form, kind of. And so these sessions were done in a very public way. They were done as a performance, so people could just come and watch this happen. And anybody paying attention, and there's a video of it, you would really begin to question the actual accuracy of the person that's being described. The person, you know, is a good person, but she has no real idea of the video that I have. But the people didn't, the description was not going to match the person. So you have these drawings that are both very specific but also completely generic. And so they just become, you know, wanted Black person, wanted Latina, you know, wanted, you know, Puerto Rican woman, and, you know, with blue jeans and a T-shirt or something like that. And so that so we had these sketch sessions. We turned them into wanted posters. The language on the wanted posters mirrored the language of wanted posters, which were just this very generic cop speak, which doesn't really help you find anybody, but does actually set a situation where everybody in the neighborhood is suspect. And then we took these wanted posters, which had the punchline or the kicker, the person is wanted by their friends, family, and community to download copies of this and display it. So it was involving people who wanted to display it and saying, we want this person in the community. We don't want them locked up. We don't want them arrested. And we went into various places. We went to bodegas. We went to delis. We went to pizza shops, nail salons, barber shops, fast food takeout places, and talked with people and said, look, we'd like to put up wanted posters. And fortunately, a lot of people said, no, you can't do that. Then we said, no, it's not what you think. These are wanted posters about how the youth are criminalized. And then everybody had a story to tell in a lot of these places. Wanted to put them up. So we were creating ambassadors to kind of talk about how the youth are treated and why people needed to fight against it, and this was a vehicle to do it. We also had large versions that were fly-pasted up on construction sites and some that were taped up around telephone poles and lamp sites, street lights and stuff. So for a couple-day period, all over 125th Street in Harlem and all up and down Lenox Avenue from 125th up to 145th, you could not miss this. And so we knew that if there was just one or two wanted posters, people would ignore them. If there were 10, people would think, oh, there must be some crime wave. But if there were 100, people would check it out and read it. And then they did, and they talked with other people, and it became sort of a real way to go up in the face of this program, which is destroying the lives of a generation of youth, and in some cases leading to their death.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to make sure that we have enough time to get into this because it's extremely important. I've got so many other questions here, man. Someday we'll have to have you back and continue. But throughout your work, you actually do a lot of emphasis on, and you have a piece on the burning of the U.S. Constitution. What you have, the original one I was talking about, what's the proper way to display the American flag. And you also, take on the impossibility, a piece that's about the impossibility of freedom in a country founded on slavery and genocide. And you're constantly pointing to, in one way or another, in a way that makes people's heads snap, you're constantly pointing to the fact that this is systemic. This is systemic to its very root, that it's rooted in what America is about. And this includes a lot of the things that people think are the ways out, whether it's the just make them live up to the Constitution or voting. And I'm going to play something now that I'd like people to listen to, and then we'll do that, and then we'll come right back, and we'll talk about this. This is something you just recently produced, all right? And, Teddy, it's track 2. Let's play that, and then we'll come back and talk with you in a minute, Trey.
Today we face a choice about who we are. They want us to vote.
The choice is about our future, and we face serious problems.
Will we let them continue to poison us?
Will we let them continue to murder us?
I can't breathe. Will we allow them to continue to warehouse us in prison?
Will men continue to be trained to dehumanize women?
This system puts our planet in peril.
Will we let this system continue to wage endless war?
Will this system continue to make our countries unlivable and detain our families?
Or will we stand together?
I know what I believe.
We need a revolution.
We need to get rid of this system, not vote for somebody else to be the head of it. I'm Dred Scott, and I approve this message.
All right, man. Dred, let's talk about that because, it gets – I think I'm going to run that almost every show between now and – It's so good. Let's talk about that, man. It's the anti-campaign ad.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is. It's an anti-campaign ad. It's actually interesting. It's the first time I've heard it just as audio. It's actually a one-minute commercial. And this was also a project that was done as part of Four Freedoms. It was, talk about what it is and then how it got created. It is a one-minute commercial that uses the language and visual structure of campaign advertising to talk about a really different, both critique that, what those campaign ads do, but also to come with a really different message. And I studied the campaign advertising of Trump and Sanders and Clinton, and they're both really extremely manipulative, but they also are extremely effective at getting their message across. They pack a lot into 60 seconds. So I really wanted to see, how do they do this? And so I studied that, and then I made this thing which said, look, the hustle that they get over when they actually sort of say, look, go vote, you're controlling the system, is people are really being controlled by the vote. They actually have narrowed down the choices to things that are acceptable from them and for them. And in this case, people have a choice of voting for a fascist or a war criminal. I mean, that, you know, what kind of choice is that? That actually sort of shows how illegitimate this whole system is. And the fact that they've gone to such great lengths to legitimize Donald Trump, I mean, it is really – people should have nothing to do with this election. And so I made this even before Trump really got kind of coronated. But it is an ad that actually says – The issues that are of deep concern to people are not being talked about in any way that's going to be resolved under this system, or and certainly not with this election. You know, the warehousing of people in prison, the murder by police, the spoiling and destruction of the planet, the rape culture that exists on campuses. None of the candidates are talking about that in any way, nor could they. They don't have any capacity to actually solve these problems under this system. And so I made this ad that actually says, look, these are the issues that people are actually thinking about and need to be thinking about. And so the commercial actually poses that's what we need, and also poses a solution. It says we need to get rid of this whole system, not to actually vote for somebody else to be the head of a system that is causing such profound suffering and literally threatening sort of the ecosystem and everything that you know, life on Earth as we know it. And so, you know, I wanted people at this moment to really kind of engage this, and so I made this like really short thing that is now available on YouTube. It's available on Vimeo. You can go to my website. You could find it. You could search for it. It's just called Anti-Campaign Ad. It'll probably show up in your browser, I hope. And it's actually, you know, to say it's gone viral would be a bit of an exaggeration, but it's been seen by over 10,000 people so far, which is, given that it's been out for about 2 weeks, is actually pretty good, and it should be seen by more. It'd be great if you played it every day, if you directed people to where they could see it. And it should be the kind of thing that people kind of really spread to think about, because it does get at a lot of the heart of how people are being – they're being used. They're being played by this election. Like, oh, man, you got to vote – you know, progressive people. Oh, wait, you got to vote for Hillary, because imagine how horrible it would be if Trump were in office. Well – I don't think Hillary's going to be a solution to the things that people are really grinding up against. They're, you know, it's like, look at all the people that are in the street. I mean, there was just a protest that shut down part of Heathrow Airport, the Black Lives Matter protest, of saying, you know, the way the police are doing people over there is similar to what's going on here, and people are taking inspiration from it. People are in the streets and courageously stood up. Even people just really have been standing up, and that's a really good thing against this murder by police, and that needs to grow. There's a new generation that's got some grit and determination, and it's really good. But that's not, you know, what's, you know, in the two conventions, you know, they were both pro-military, and one was just straight-up fascist with Fang's beard. The other one was pro-military, and they had, you know, Blue Lives Matter people on. And so, you know, all these people who are demanding that black people be treated as human beings, each of the two major political parties all over them. So Anti-Campaign Ad sort of says, you know, to hell with all of this. We need to get rid of this system, but also really focusing back on the issues that people are actually talking about and stirring about and impassioned about, and not, you know, go for this okey-doke where we get played into framing things the way that this system wants to frame them.
Just we have about maybe six minutes left, and there's two things I wanted to ask you. And one, I just have to throw in on this right now, which because it's part of what happens too in your work is that, and one of the things that's so powerful about it is that you don't let people have like the sort of looking at things as sort of like, oh my God, yes, that's horrible. And then, okay, what am I going to do now? You actually challenge people to recognize that when they're looking at things like voting and they're looking at all these other ways. I mean, you have this one piece that I mentioned earlier about the impossibility of freedom in a country founded on slavery and genocide, which is extraordinary in terms of you're walking against and fighting to get a few inches with a guy holding a fire hose on you, you know, and it not only harkens up back in the 60s, but currently the thing of like the insanity of constantly trying to save to change the system by relying on the system itself. And you actually – you've said in a number of places, you've actually made this point about – and I think in the Dred Scott decision, this piece that you did, that also I'd recommend people go to your website and see it. It's an extremely powerful piece. And you talk about that when people go in and vote, that voting isn't a neutral act, that it's actually giving your approval to everything that's going on by voting to keep the system going.
Yeah. No, I mean, people are complicit in what the candidates they actually vote for are going to do. And so – people need to actually, you know, wise up to what's going on and not continue to lend their support, even if they're like, well, no, what I'm doing is trying to stop the lesser of two evils, or trying to stop the greater of two evils, you know, by voting for the lesser of two evils. but you're actually sort of complicit in shifting things further and further to the right. It is not where change has happened in the past, and it's not where change will happen in the future. It's like slavery wasn't ended by voting. I mean, in the piece you talked about, you know, Dred Scott decision, that's a project that actually, I mean, it has three components. I read the verbatim text of the Dred Scott decision, which I really encourage people to read. It is the most thoroughly well-articulated argument for white supremacy I've ever read, and obviously I don't agree with it, but it's coming from the mouth of a Supreme Court justice who is arguing that, look, the founding fathers never thought of, you know, Africans and enslaved people as human beings or as citizens, and let's stop all this bullshit. We got to actually just get back down to just naked ownership of people. And so there was that. There were four nude black performers who were being menaced and corralled by German Shepherd dogs that were live German Shepherd dogs, and people had the opportunity to go vote. And it really posed the question, it posed an ethical question what they were voting on between the relationship between slavery, mass incarceration, and voting. And it opened up with, would you have voted during slavery, and would you vote in a segregated election? And so it was really getting people to think. I mean, most people obviously think slavery's wrong. But then we have this mass incarceration, and people don't like it. But then the solution many people are putting forward is we got to get a better candidate in, or we got to get some legislative action or something. And this system can't solve that problem. And I keep coming back to it is systemic. And so people, where change has happened, even if people aren't ready for revolution, it's like the fact that black people can say, sit down at the lunch counter with white people, it was because people went and broke the laws. They went and defied the laws of segregation in Jim Crow. They risked a lot and sometimes got beaten and killed. That's how change has happened. Voting, it's like around, you know, Roe versus Wade. That came because women were demanding it, not because Nixon suddenly had a change of heart and said, oh, well, I think, you know, you've got the pro-choice candidate in office. That's not what happened. And so, you know, a lot of my work deals with just how systemic and entrenched it is. And on the project on the impossibility of freedom in a country founded on slavery and genocide, I'm walking against the battering water jet of a fire hose, hearkening back to 1963 in Birmingham, where civil rights demonstrators were fire hosed by Bull Connor to basically keep legalized segregation in effect, and Jim Crow segregation in effect, which sometimes included people getting lynched. And so people defied that courageously, and that link with people resisting is what the hope lies in, people recognizing and confronting the horrific situation we're in and acting collectively to stop it. And I, you know, always keep the door open. I am always struggling for, we need revolution, we need revolution, we need revolution. It's not in every work, but that's the answer to what people are up against. And you know, it's like, so I don't hustle people into, you know, something that will make them feel good as like, oh yes, if we can, you know, we have, if we can just get them, the cops, to wear body cameras, then everything will be all right. Well, we've seen video after video after video of cops murdering people, and it doesn't send a single one of them to jail or stop any more from continuing the crimes they're going to commit.
Let me ask you this, Dred, and we have about 3 minutes, and we have to stick tight on that. But real quick, one of the things that you always talk about in relation to your work, and that much of your work points to, is the fact that the whole point about imagine a world without America. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that for 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah. Well, imagine a world without America. It's a really simple piece. It's a square piece that has a map of the world on it. And the way, you know, most wherever you live, the country that makes your maps, it's probably going to have your country in the center. Well, you know, most of the people that are seeing this work are going to be in America. So the fact that the map has Europe and Africa in the center is a bit unusual, but it has that. And the way it's framed, it just happens to, you get to see Alaska, you get to see Florida through Maine, but the rest of America and also Canada gets cut off. But then it has text that says, imagine a world, and then very, very faintly it says, without America. And I really do want people to imagine a world they'd want to live in. Because many people I know, this world, the world as it exists today, is not the world they want to live in. It's the world we're given. And so I want them to do a thought experiment. And, you know, it's like whether you think America's a force for good or look for it to be in the dustbin of history as I do, it has disproportionate influence, whether it's, you know, say hip-hop culture existing in the slums of Khayelitsha in South Africa or on the walls of Rome, which is, I think, a good thing, or whether it's drones flown by kids in Colorado bombing people in Pakistan, or whether it's the economic system, which is just wreaking havoc with the planet, or whether it's the denial of science that's meaning that AIDS is on the increase in Africa. All those things are because of America, and we can go down a really long list. And so I really do want people to imagine a world and complicate that imagining and wrangling with imagine it without America being in it. And then you can actually get someplace. It's not that suddenly makes America go away. It's not about the landmass and it's not about the people, but it is actually dreaming and lifting people's sights to the world they actually really want to live in. And then on that basis, let's figure out how we get there.
All right, Dred Scott, thank you very much for joining us today. And tell people before we go, tell people where they can find your website.
Okay, it's dredscott.net, DREADSCOTT.net.
All right, Dred, take care. And thanks a lot for joining us today. And have you back soon, man. All right, take care, man. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with revolutionary artist Dred Scott about his work inspiring beautiful and provocative works of art he's been doing for decades. And some of his works, including A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday, were recently included in a show called For Freedoms in New York City. And he describes it as an updated version of a flag that the NAACP used to hang from their national headquarters in New York whenever someone was lynched. And he has added, A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday. All right, so that's Dred Scott. And like he said, go to his website, check this out. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with revolutionary artist Dred Scott about his work inspiring beautiful and provocative works of art he's been doing for decades. And some of his works, including A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday, were recently included in a show called For Freedoms in New York City. And he describes it as an updated version of a flag that the NAACP used to hang from their national headquarters in New York whenever someone was lynched. And he has added, A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday. All right, so that's Dred Scott. And like he said, go to his website, check this out. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Hurricane Season by Trombone Shorty. Now we're going to hear from Bob Avakian and Cornel West talking about why are we still fighting for justice in 2015.
These two connected questions that I'm going to ask. One is in the reference to the June 4th raid in Harlem. The question is, how do we as a community approach the NYPD and our city officials to demand justice and free our children now, who are now incarcerated? That's right. They're now incarcerated, all facing conspiracy charges and life in prison. We need help. And then, which is a very powerful question. The second is I think, related from someone in Ferguson, Missouri.
Right on.
And they asked, why are we in 2015 still going through this hell? Because I never thought I'd be still fighting for justice.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful question. Wonderful question. And as I said before, though, that there's a sense in which the struggle for freedom is a perennial struggle because there's progress and then regress. For the last 30 years, there's been a class war against poor and working people, disproportionately targeting young folk of color. And the results of that class war has produced what we're dealing with right now. And that was regress. So we had breakthrough on the one hand, we had regress on the other. The breakthrough was one in which you ended up with the expansion of a black professional class and a black middle class and even a few black top dogs in terms of poor, who more and more find themselves unable to even find a role in the society in terms of jobs, in terms of status, stature. And that is unbelievable regress. And we're dealing with the consequences of that regress. And so in that sense, you would think, well, my God, 2015, we thought, lo and behold, with Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer and the others, that we would be able to be closer to black freedom. No, that's not the case at all. That the ruling class in America won the class war over the last 35 years. And we're responding to that triumph from above. And what is wonderful is the degree to which the young folk are willing to fight. And Ferguson is just, I think, the beginning. We're going to see a whole wave of activism among the young folk. And the beautiful thing is that the sisters, the black sisters, will play a fundamental role. Yeah, Tef Poe, that's beautiful, but oh, you got Ashley Yates. Oh, yes, you got Tori Russell, but oh, you got Sister Alexis, and on. It's going to be a collective, mutually gendered and trans affair, which was very different than what it was when we were coming along, because we know how deep that patriarchy was. Isn't that the truth, though?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, Lord, indeed. That's why I appreciate your critique of patriarchy, especially for an old school brother like you hitting hard like that. I'm old school, too, but I mean, you'd be
well,
surprised.
Well, we have to keep on learning. Right?
Exactly. We got to keep on learning.
Well, I would say, I think these two questions are very much related. I would say the basic answer to the question of why we still have to fight after all this time is because we're still living under the same system. And unless and until we get rid of the system, the same things are going to keep on happening, even if they happen in some different ways. Like I was thinking about Detroit. The most powerful urban rebellion in the 1960s took place in Detroit in 1967. Now, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just telling you the facts. The people rose up in Detroit, and yes, they came in and they killed a lot of them. But they rose up for 5 days. And after they killed them, they said, oh, man, we've got a really serious problem here. And they went and started hiring thousands of black people right off the street into the auto plants of Detroit. And those were high-paying jobs. Now, people always, and again, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just telling you the truth when they always say, oh, when people rise up, it doesn't do any good. It never does anything good. All it does is harm, ruin our own communities. They came and they hired thousands of people right off the street. And then they commissioned the Kerner Commission report. Yeah. You remember saying, oh, we've been mistreating black people. Who knew? And they started talking about how they kind of had to make all these changes.
Absolutely.
But now here's the thing. Here we are almost 50 years later. All those jobs that they hired those thousands of people into are gone. Most of the auto plants are closed down. Detroit is a basket case. I don't care they talk about how they got some kind of resolution to the bankruptcy. It's a basket case. Many people in Detroit can't even get water. Decent water. Think about that. A large number of people. And that's because it's more profitable, like you were just talking about, for them to close down those plants and to open them in some country where they can force the people to work for much lower wages and to replace people by machines. And when they replace people by machines in this system, they don't go to them and say, oh, we're putting you out of a job, but clearly you need to live, so let us train you for another job. They just say, hit the street, you're gone. Because this is the nature of the system. It's a system driven by ruthless competition among capitalists, which drives them to exploit people and to throw them out of work if they can't exploit them enough to make enough profit.
Absolutely.
So what does that prove? Does it prove that it was wrong for people to rise up in Detroit? No. Does it prove that it's wrong for people to be rising up now? Does it do no good to struggle? You might as well just accept it because they'll just beat you down anyway? No. It's very important that people rise up, that they did so then, and I agree with you. We could be on the start of a whole new wave of struggle. But where is it going to go? Are we going to still be facing the same thing 50 years later down the road? Maybe not us, but other people who are coming behind us? Or can we actually get rid of the system and put in place an economic system that is geared to the needs of the people, not the profit of a few, and a political system that goes along with that economic system? So that's one question. Mm-hmm. Now, the other question, and I do think it's very much related, the police went rampaging into these housing projects. This is what they do to our youth all the time. Everybody talks about the prison pipeline from the neighborhood to prison. And this is what they are consciously doing with their mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow that you mentioned, the book by Michelle Alexander. Mm-hmm. This is what they're consciously doing. They put a jacket on these kids from the time they're not even teenagers. And then you've got a record. So now you've got a record. Next time you run into the police, they run you through the system, you've got a record. You're already heading toward being a felon, being convicted of a felony, and then being sent to prison. And then your whole family is affected by the fact that you're sent to prison. That's if right. You survive long enough to be sent to prison. So, you know, these raids they carry out charging conspiracy. They're going and they're taking the social media of these youth. You know how youth are. You're talking about gangster proclivities. You know? Youth, they like to talk big. They like to talk bad. You know, I'm going to do this to you. I'm going to do that to you. They took all that stuff as if it were meant literally and said, this is all, you know, just talking bad on the social media, and acted as if this were actually conspiracies that they were waging to go out and kill a bunch of people and sell drugs. I mean, you could take almost any rap song, and they do that too, and convict a rapper of conspiracy to commit all kinds of crimes, because that's what they often talk about in a rap. So where's your artistic freedom? Where's the freedom for these youth to express? They don't even... Look, you know, I've often thought, sometimes walking down the street, and I have something in my pocket, and I've often thought, as I pull out of my pocket, if I were black, I might be dead now. Because I pulled something out of my pocket that could be construed to look like a gun or some kind of weapon. You don't have, if they've got these youth in the inner cities are under a state of siege where all the rights that we're told we have, they don't have. They don't even have the right to express themselves through social media.
Now, we cannot
accept this. This can't go down. And we've got to go out among not just the people who are directly to answer the question about what do we do about this. We can't just go out among the people who are directly affected by this. We have to go out broadly into society. We have to go out among all the diverse kind of people who are represented here tonight and say, you have to know about what is going on in this country of yours, in this society, where supposedly we have a democracy and supposedly we have rights for the people. But if you live in a certain part of town and you're a certain color and you're looked at by the system in a certain way, you don't have any of even those supposed rights. And we cannot allow that to go on. We've got to, it's our responsibility.
That's right.
It's our party's responsibility. And I'm determined that we live up to our responsibility, but it's also everybody's responsibility to go broadly. We got to go to the students. In the 60s, I was a student in the 60s on the college campus. That's how I got involved in the free speech movement and then working with the Black Panther Party and fighting against the Vietnam War. Why? Because when you get into it, when you're a student, I know a lot of them waste their time on nonsense, but at least when you're a student in college, you have the opportunity to learn about a lot of things if you want to do so and you take some initiative to do so. You have ideas that you can work with. You have the life of the mind that you can pursue if you have a mind to do it. And in the 60s, a lot of students did that. They looked at the world around them. Like I said, they saw people rising up and they said, I want to know what this is about. I want to understand this.
But I think in the 60s, we had something else, too. And this is a result of the cultural and spiritual war that went hand in hand with the class war. That when we turned on the radio and heard the voice of a David Ruffin, or when we turned on the radio and heard Sheila and Wanda Hutchison of the Emotions singing, there was a tenderness and a sweetness and a kindness that is the raw stuff of any kind of movement.
Right.
Whereas today, you know, it's say my name, as opposed to try a little tenderness, old as Redden. It's hard to find tenderness, sweetness, and kindness. Same is true in terms of the collectivities. You see, when we turn on the radio, who did we hear? We heard the Delphonics and the Dramatics. We heard Enchantment. You see, we heard Lakeside. We heard Ohio Players. Heaven Must Be Like This and Skin Tight. We heard a tenderness and a sweetness. When they turn on the radio today with the oligarchs and plutocrats, the same ones who control recording and radio and video and live performance. That's exactly right, though, brother. I love that. It's a cultural, spiritual kind of COMINTELPRO. If somehow we can make sure that the precious souls of young black people, and of course by young black people, you're talking about all folk, because young people have been Afro-Americanized since Motown, since the Funkadelic, since James Brown. So if we can keep their souls so chilly, and I see this in teaching in prisons for 37 years, I can see the shift in it. to keep the soul so chilly, the conscience so coarsened, and the heart so hardened that you don't have the raw stuff for a movement. People can't wait just to get over, to manipulate and dominate, or be obsessed with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Because everybody's just trying to get over by any means. That's Wall Street. Not one Wall Street executive went to jail given all the crimes that took place in 2008. They didn't get caught yet. But that sends the same kind of sign in the young folk. But again, when talking about black people, you got to talk about our spirits and our souls and bodies, as well as the organizing and mobilizing, or we'll never be able to pull it off.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think that,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I agree. I think that culture is very important. I mean, if you go back to the beginnings of hip-hop and you leave aside sort of silly things like Rapper's Delight or whatever, you know, which had a nice beat, but it wasn't about much.
And a brother just died, too, you know?
Yeah.
That brother just died. God bless his soul.
But then you got, you know, Melly Mel.
Grandmaster Flash,
Melly Mel. Then you got Public Enemy with Chuck D.
KRS-One,
Wu-Tang
Clan.
They were talking about something.
Oh, yes.
And what happened? The people who control things in the music industry and in general came in and said, we don't want that.
Right.
Ice-T went from being cop killer to being a cop on TV. And they said, This is the way you want to make it. This is the way you make it. All the rest of that stuff, we're going to push that aside and not let it flourish. But I think what's happening now, when you talk about a new wave, when you have a new wave of struggle, it brings forward or can bring forward a new culture. And I agree with you. I mean, I grew up on those songs that had tenderness and love, too. You know,
that's
it's very
rich,
different.
Rich stuff.
It's not weak to love. I think that's something very important.
That's exactly right.
It is not weak to love. It is not weak to treat other people as human beings. And we need a culture that grows together with the actual struggle and is a crucial part of the struggle that promotes the kind of values you're talking about, that promotes looking out for each other and being together and seeing what we have in common instead of trying to get over on each other. And I believe, I mean, let me look. I forget his, I can't call his
Johannes
name right.
Johannes Hernandez. Give it up for Sister Johannes Hernandez, leader of the Mumias Bu Jamal movement, along with Mark Taylor. We love you. We love you, Johannes. We love you, Johannes. Love you, though, sister. No, I'm sorry to take
it. No, that's all right. No, we got to pay respect.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
I can't call his name, but I know there was a rapper recently who did, after the assassination of Michael Brown, came out with a song about that. I can't remember. There you go. Right? Now, that's just, you know, that's an example of what happens. It wasn't just...
That's right.
Here's the important thing, I think. It wasn't just because yet another black or brown youth was killed in cold blood. It's because people stood up and said, no, we don't care.
Right.
We're not taking this anymore.
That's right.
And that's what inspired a little spark of a new culture. And the more that happens, the more that we can bring forward that culture. And I agree, we need that culture.
Oh, yeah.
I do agree. I may not agree we need to get it from God, but I agree that we need soul and we need heart.
I agree. I mean, the wonderful thing is that God doesn't ask for your permission. I'm just playing with you, brother.
Well, if I ever hear God asking for my permission, I might change my view.
Oh, Lord. A lot of people see some divine qualities in the love for the masses that you all have in the party. Now you got to watch it.
That was Bob Avakian and Cornel West talking about why are we still fighting for justice in 2015. Now, this is a segment from the DVD Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. You can get the whole DVD at revcom.us, which is where you can also find much more about Bob Avakian, his leadership, and his new synthesis of communism. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, revolutionary artist Dred Scott, and also Bob Avakian and Cornel West for making available their dialogue on a DVD at revcom.us, as I already said. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Matt Kriklinski, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Raquel Casbah from Rashid Taha.
get a boogeyman. Another rag of a crow. Which head of